Conference record. Have joined the conference.
Stretch, how we think about reviewing recommendations and so on, because we have some direction about how the MRT overall wants us to do that. We have to sort of tread a fine line between our preferences and what they're requesting. So we'll have some conversation there. Then we've got two substantive presentations, both of which will lead into some conversation. One of those is an update from the kids working group, which is going remarkably well, but is not quite done yet. And so Gail is off taking care of herself also. So Kristen Riley will lead us through that update. I think, Kristen, that they, you know, sort of knock on wood, that that subgroup is hoping to have a full report at our next meeting. Right. So that's a very aggressive schedule, and that's a good thing to hear. And then we'll have we'll take a little bit more time for a discussion of what we learned and what we still need to do related to several issues that, in a sense, started us down this road. There was this a set of significant incidents in New York City a few years ago that, when examined in detail, revealed how discontinuities in treatment were really the underlying concern of people of high concern. And so we've made some initial efforts over the last couple of years to address that through the care monitoring initiative that have taught us some more things, but also taught us what still remains to be done, which in a way is kind of what our assignment is. So we'll go through that, and that'll lead into a conversation. And then we've got a second substantive presentation, which is an update on and really preliminary recommendations on performance standards for managed care. And so Susan Essick will present that. That's a set of recommendations that are drawn from looking at what's going on around the country, but also from our conversations already, some spin-off stuff from the health homes and so on. Then there's a short list of complex items at the bottom here under outstanding issues that relate to not all the major issues that we haven't got to yet, but some of the big issues that we haven't got to yet. And I think, you know, sort of my hope about that, I don't know whether this will work, but my hope is that we can get into a substantive conversation about those issues and see if we have, we're certainly not going to get to detailed recommendations, but see if we have a general understanding or agreement in the group about the direction that we ought to be going in on those broad issues. And if we have a pretty good sense about the direction we ought to be going in, that'll give us good guidance to work over the next month to come back with some more detailed recommendations for the group to consider. So a lot of work to be done, but I think we're pretty well prepared for it. That's just sort of my summary of it. And now that we're, you know, sort of all around the table and ready to go. Anna, Linda, do you have any other introductory comments, or do you want to take us into the next?
Yeah, sure. And so in your packet in front of you, you have the Behavioral Health Subcommittee report outline, and it's sort of a marked-up version reflecting comments that we've gotten since the last meeting. And I'm not going to I won't go through them, but I do want everybody to pay attention to them because they're going to be the basis of the report. Maybe it's worth saying, Mike and I met with Jason Helgerson and Jim Introne to give them an update on where we stand, where the conversations are, a little sort of a heads up of here's, it was after our last meeting, here's where the group's conversation is, here's the format we intend to outline these recommendations in a report. I would say that they were incredibly supportive, thankful, and encouraging. And we're squirming a little when we talked about the reinvestment needs. So there, you know, shows rational thinking on their part. And so, so it's worth saying, we've before we got further instruction from the sort of headquarters on how to present recommendations, we had established this report outline with the idea of presenting them a report. Since then, they've posted a request to all of the work groups to put the details of the recommendations in recommendation format that looks very much like what the Medicaid redesign team did back in the spring, which I think is a helpful format. What we want to do is to keep to our plan of doing report, which, you know, essentially will be full paragraphs rather than bullets of what you see in the outline, and then to back that up with the templates as requested. And so essentially we can almost footnote the report with the template so that they can flip over for each of for the recommendations into the templates being filled out. The reason I do think that that's good is that the templates are very clear. You know, just it'll force us to get more concrete for those things that rise to the level of being fleshed out in a fully sort of fleshed out template recommendation, and it includes a recognition of sort of cost and savings. So it'll sort of force you know, we've been saying that we could use a little budget help on this stuff, so it'll sort of force us to go through the exercise of doing some costing out and getting some of that embedded in the process. So I think by our goal would be, and this could be an overstatement, but why not shoot high, our goal would be to get by the next meeting the draft report plus the templates to you in whatever fashion they are. And that may be sort of completed, or that may be with lots of blanks. And I would imagine to do that, we're going to have to draw on some of your help and expertise for the individual pieces that you might be familiar with. So which now coming back to this outline really means from after this meeting that we're going to have to take this outline and turn it into product. So I would say there's, you know, it's the, you know, we're about to cross the finish line just on sort of basic ideas in terms of what should be in this outline. You know, so now is the moment. And how should we, 24 hours? 5 minutes? How many, you know, last opportunity for comment? What would you like to suggest? Or did that pass? Did we say it absolutely passes 5 days ago? I don't know.
On the outline here?
Yeah. I think we've talked about most of this stuff already. What you'll, in the track change format that you've got, I think what's true is that the senior staff have incorporated suggestions. So this is the stuff that's in blue that's come from a number of different people, but most significantly from OASAS. And you'll see a couple of kids references there that have come from the kids group. You also see included the recommendations we made related to health homes. And parenthetically, we sent out in advance of the meeting some stuff that's come from DOH that reflects that we've made a lot of agreement, and I would underline what Linda had said about the conversation we had with them. The health home stuff is still pretty open on the one hand. On the other hand, they have incorporated a number of our more robust recommendations, and the fact that they also have extended the timeline for implementation to provide time to work things out, I think was also, you know, sort of good reality testing, and we felt was supportive of the, some of the kinds of concerns that we were raising. Yeah, Pam?
So I may be missing something here, that on the ever-evolving health home sort of policy decisions, I guess I'm a little confused about.
The only one.
I'm sure. Whether it's so that health homes must have a behavioral health component, which I thoroughly agree with, what is the difference between saying that and putting together a sort of robust physical behavioral health plan and being a special needs population?
I think that's a really good question that I can describe my take on, but I'm not 100% sure that this reflects common understandings. So I think I'll say, first of all, I think there's an acceptance by all of the parties that all health homes, whether or not they enroll people who primarily come with significant behavioral health
experiences, all health homes are going to have a more than casual behavioral health component. And so one of the things that we've said as a recommendation is, you know, screening depression / ESPERT with the capability to do something about it in every health home. So I think that has been accepted as a matter of principle, if not operationally. So the operational part, you know, that's still going to be tested. So that's my first comment. My second comment is that the development of health homes remains something that's going to be staged with, you know, you remember the four quadrants on Greg's presentation that I can't even remember what they are, but there are four different quadrants. And the intense period of health home development now through November is for two primary populations, if I have it right. And one is the population with significant behavioral health issues and problems. And the second is for the high need but disconnected population. What that suggests to me is that for both of those populations, but absolutely for the first one, there's going to have to be a very robust behavioral health participation in the network, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I think that that's self-evident. I don't think anybody at DOH would disagree with it. At the same time, it's not formally out there as a guidance yet. I think that's sort of okay for now. We proceed with development of the health homes in a fashion that also, you know, sort of frankly includes the relevant state agencies in the, you know, in conversations about is this health home application from Chautauqua County, you know, sort of okay or not on these issues. And I think that's actually what we're going to have to do. So this is, and we have agreed to this with DOH that there will be working sessions where we get the expressions of interest that have come in, and that the people from the relevant state agencies would sit together to have a conversation about how does this network look,
great.
How does this network
That's
look,
great.
And then if we have a situation, let's say for example, where we've got a health home proposal from a given community that's got no participation from the major addiction provider or from the mental health case management agency, I think our job is going to be to say timeout. We need to sort of make a call and see if we can work out their involvement. So that's my picture of it. And Bob, Bob's saying that I'm pretty much right. Is that's not that concrete, but is that
well? It addresses part of my question, but not the part about is there any kind of a special needs program that's going to go forward. It would seem to me that
right.
what used to be a special needs program could be a health home, no?
Well, and that's sort of in a way, I guess, you know, my take on that is that the answer to that question lies in between, in a sense, the health home on the one hand and the stage 2 BHO on the other.
Okay.
And so if we end up having... as we've already said, it would be our intention to have a special needs plan approach in New York City, which is not to exclude other areas, but if that would be the dominant approach there, then we've got to figure out down the road how does the health home thing jive with the developing plan thing, and that's a conversation that's going to have to take place later on down the road. In the initial phase of the health home, the health home is not a it's not a plan, although a plan might participate
right.
in it.
Right.
It's not a risk-bearing
right.
entity. It's a
right.
it's more ACO-ish in a
yes,
way
it's
than
a it's a collection of
it's a collection of so anyway.
Yes, absolutely.
And one of the big issues is, you know, not only in designing it right and but also in preventing high need individuals from needing to switch health homes
right.
multiple times
right.
and being more disruptive as we try to get them
oh,
to
absolutely.
The special needs plan venue, right.
right?
And so I think that's the kind of thinking
yeah.
about how do you structure this in a way to prevent that and to be mindful of that from the get-go in the first stage.
Right. So one thing I just want to make sure I heard you say, that really designation of health homes is going to be an interagency proposition.
Good. Yes.
That's great.
Yeah, Betty?
I also have concerns about point of entry into health homes, thinking particularly of individuals with addictive disorders who have historically been stigmatized by the general medical community, and the risk, the real potential that they won't follow through with that. And I wonder if there's any way that can be looked at that, you know, those are high needs populations, those are special needs populations.
Right.
And to expect that they're just going to enter through a doctor's office and follow through with anything they're supposed to do can be highly unlikely because of the reception they receive, particularly those who have the severe disorders where there have been multiple entries into the system.
So I think, I mean, just the best response to that, I mean, I'm sort of noting that point, but I think I'm pretty sure that, so Rob OASAS will carry that issue through the interagency review of the networks and applications and so on.
So following up on the entry, the question about entry into the health home system, I have, I wonder actually how, since the money is flowing for the most part, unless this changes, through the plan, and since the new applicants or the new clients or consumers will be assigned to health homes through the plans, what oversight is in place to see that there are no conflicts of interest, especially in instances where the plans themselves are health homes?
Oh.
I'm not sure that I see it evolving that way. You know, I think the there's going to be, we don't know the extent to which there's going to be plan participation in health homes. So the plans may apply to be a part of the health home team, but the health home does not require plan participation in an explicit kind of way. Now, there's certainly members of plans that are going to be participating, so there are some, there are going to be some tensions there to work, you know, to work through. You know, a lot of the payment will still be eMedney payment.
You know? For existing clients, right?
Right.
For targeted cases.
Right.
But not for necessarily new right. business or new clients.
I just, you know, I'm not sure the if there's a if there's one answer to that that we could create that would work or be acceptable. That issue is going to have to get worked through. We know that.
Yeah, so it's a conflict of interest, potential conflict of interest.
Can you elaborate on the conflict, Bill?
Well, I don't know.
For the provider or the plan?
The
plan.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant for the provider. No.
For the plan.
Right. I mean, because it could go both ways.
I'm envisioning, and I guess, and Mike has a very different vision, but I was envisioning a system in which some plans, at least, are the lead of in a health home network, and those same plans will be working in New York City, at least, with other health homes, maybe in the same surrounding areas, and new clients will be coming through the plan. And what's to stop the plan from making sure that the new clients stay in their health home and not go to the other health homes that are also in place?
I thought you were going to say to stop them from ensuring that the new members would be going into the health plan. I mean, there's going to be some
movement
into the health plan as well.
Health home assignment. It's going to be an assignment.
Right.
State level.
So you're talking about new patients.
Yes, there's actually something the Department of Health that I can't remember, but it was in a piece of paper, and in the last health homes webinar, I might have printed it after that. It says that the new clients will be assigned to health homes by the plans.
If they're in a plan, the plan assigns them to the health home. If they are not in a plan, the state assigns them.
The health department is assigning people, but you're suggesting that after the original assignments, when new people come into a plan,
that they will be assigned to health homes by the plan.
No, I guess
must be the only person right. under that.
Yeah. What I want to do is put this in the parking lot as a concern, and back up to. One of the items that we didn't talk about too much, but that the conversation we had at the last meeting about how these assignments will work, and I remember, Donna, you talked a lot about, you know, sort of getting this right with respect to people, you know, that not being misassigned, let's say, based on a few Medicaid claims when they were getting very significant non-Medicaid services somewhere else. We talked about that in a fair amount of detail, and the DOH people were very responsive to the concerns that, you know, had emerged in the room. That was very helpful. That, you know, the question about new assignments going forward, I think we have to sort of, you know, take under advisement to monitor.
So maybe let's take a few. I also want to get back to this outline. So maybe let's take a few more comments. Or
back to the outline. I'm seeing, you know, in the first paragraph this to explore peer and managed addiction treatment services, and I don't see anything throughout the rest of the document about the inclusion of peer support to peer-provided services.
Well, that's what we'll talk about later in this meeting.
Great.
Because it was there. It was originally.
It was there more fluently, but it's not there at all now.
What we have in the first paragraph is the MRT charge.
Right.
You know, so and to be explicit, what I think the place that we should be talking about that is when we have later on the agenda the discussion of the Mental Health Criminal Justice Review panel. The issue of engagement that the panel focused on that in a variety of different ways, but the big bang way that the panel approached it was the care monitoring initiative. So we'll talk about that, but I think we also ought to stop talk and have a conversation about what are the multiple ways that people can be engaged,
mm-hmm.
which is an entree for us to talk about peer stuff. I should also say, I don't want to be, you know, getting in trouble on this, but there's some kind of an MRT peer services group that isn't an official subcommittee. They've had some meetings,
yes.
But it hasn't been deep
mm-hmm.
or something.
Well, we're getting to a place where last week they were, Jackie Allman from Health Department, was pulling together some recommendations and said that apparently in an email they had to come through this group.
Well, yeah, so this is what I would describe as a referral has been made. And the reason why they want that working group to come through here apparently is under the Constitution of the State of New York or the MRT rules, I don't know which. Issues have got to come back to the full MRT through an official subcommittee. So we become the host subcommittee for that work group. So that, which as long as you guys do your work, Harvey, and produce a good report, I'm sure the group here will have no trouble with it. But it'll give us another bite at the apple of peer services.
Because there also, Mike, is the Coalition to Protect the Integrity of Peer Support throughout New York State. And they've been meeting quite in depth and meeting with Jackie Allman and the rest of the DOH.
And I'm sure there's going to be a consensus recommendation that emerges.
Bring some of that to the table.
Can I mention, Michael, we're going to come back a little bit more later, but is all of that to say that we can sort of rest a little bit easier knowing that this group is going to bring detail and that ultimately will get loaded into our product? Is that?
Or maybe I don't know how they want us to, but maybe we just pass it on with our approval and comment.
The question is, does it sort of take a little bit of the pressure off of this outline to handle it in full?
I think so.
Because we're going to...
Alan? I would just say is that there's
a risk... You know what, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Probably means that we would want to hear those recommendations by the meeting on the 12th.
Yeah. Right.
So I don't know.
Which we have today, actually, some of them. So I would hate to see it to be something so different. You know, so separate because, you know, it's about peer services being, you know, brought together and be integrated. So by separating them, that kind of keeps that momentum going. I'd rather see it more integrated.
I guess there would be an underlying assumption that there's a good cross-section of peer groups involved in that discussion, so that there's a good representation from substance use disorders.
There is on that group.
Good.
Richard Buckman.
Good.
People like that.
Good.
He actually just, I'll show you the emails
good.
If you want.
So maybe actually let me grab the floor here then and take an issue that might go, the suggestion would be in a little bit of the opposite direction. They're convening some of the additional work groups. One of those is the work group on, they're now calling it affordable housing, which includes all of the supportive housing conversation. The co-chairs of that work group will be Jim Introne and Ed Matthews. And And that work group is going to be convened before the end of this month. The intent is that it will cover, there's a few populations that need to be addressed in that work group, including the elderly, the frail elderly, our behavioral health population, and the disabilities population. They intend to look at each of those populations in the conversation around housing support. And so in sort of an email conversation with Mike, we were trying to just play out in our minds how to get the work done as it relates to the behavioral health housing issues. And we're sort of forming a recommendation to this group that in our report we make recommendations but don't, again, feel sort of the obligation to take it all the way through to the detail, knowing that essentially saying we want to delegate the responsibility around addressing the full behavioral health housing issues to that work group, and that the fully fleshed out housing recommendation should be done there.
I'm sorry, did you say the name of the co-chair of that group, Syndrome?
Ed Matthews.
Okay, thanks.
And again, the only caveat I would say is that we make sure that, again, that the groups are really representative of the entire kind of diversity we have here, that it's a balanced discussion.
So I guess there the challenge will be they try to keep the groups to, I think we might be on the large size, and to the extent that they have additional populations, they've got to add more diversity of their own. And so clearly having the expertise, and I think, you know, the lead in this model in New York State and in the country has been on the behavioral health side.
I guess if you're going to take their recommendations and somehow infuse them a little bit into ours, we can sort of tweak it to make sure it's got the balance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really think that's what Linda was saying.
Yeah. Good.
We give them a pretty strong handoff and then let them do the rest of the work.
Yeah.
Linda, when did you say that was starting up?
By the end of this month, so that's another week, right? So within a week or so, and I think that's going to be a lot of very complicated work. Where, probably, you know, my recommendation would be that they look beyond the Medicaid budget for savings in thinking about sort of a more comprehensive housing approach. I don't know entirely why they're calling it affordable housing rather than supportive housing. It's
right.
The group name changed, but we'll find out.
Right. Definitely not affordable.
The other group
right.
that was announced recently that I'm just wanting to know if you have any information about the overlay is CSIC benefits. I looked at the list of folks on that committee, so I know overt, you know, didn't pop out at me as behavioral health experts or consumers or stakeholders or anything.
And as soon as I got your email, we fired off a semi-snotty email suggesting that. And
Jason sent one, like, right back that said Henry Chung is a member of that group. I had missed. And Henry Chung is really good on these issues as a psychiatrist who has worked in
a number of settings, including health. I mean, he ran the Chinatown Health Center. So I think we don't have a formal representative in a sense, but I you know, he's very good on the questions of, you know, behavioral health issues in primary care.
So my comment then just respectfully still stands with regards to consumers and other stakeholders who are not. It's mostly doctors and...
Well, they've got to defend themselves on that one.
And health plans.
Right.
Okay.
One of the issues that I think is a concern are the folks that may be dropping in and out of Medicaid because of incarcerations. They are high risk, high need, and how do we incorporate those into, you know, either the health homes or plans, or so that there's not, you know, I don't want to say a dump, but, you know, denial of service that results in a shift in the location and the payer of that. And I think that becomes an issue that somehow we need to figure out how we're going to address here. It's definitely a concern of the counties moving forward, whether or not it's in the children's side, and we've talked about it at the children and families group, as well as in the adult group.
Right.
So I wonder on that one whether we can slow the action down for just a second and whether we could try to get a couple or three consensus ideas about that, because I think we might be able to relatively quickly get a couple, three consensus ideas and then sort of move toward including those. I'm not sure that this is that we're the only place that's going to be thinking about this, but certainly the LGU participation here makes that critical. So here are a couple of my thoughts and see if this, how helpful this is. One thought in that regard is that there has to be an increased effort on achieving and sustaining Medicaid eligibility for Medicaid eligible people who might be in circumstances where they would lose that eligibility, like, you know, become incarcerated. So that the state has got to do, you know, a very good job, which probably means a better job, of doing things like, turning off utilization rather than eliminating eligibility for people that are incarcerated, for example. So that's one recommendation, is to sort of do a better job with maintaining eligibility for people who might be eligible. It's in the city, but not upstate.
I don't know.
County by county.
Okay. So we have to extend what the city has done to the rest of the state. You know, suspend rather than terminate.
Doesn't mean we figured it out though, and there is still lots of guys. Lots of people that are in the system who are not eligible, and improving the enrollment process.
Right. The state law was changed a couple of budgets ago that it is to be suspended for individuals going who become incarcerated but were on Medicaid at the time they were incarcerated.
Yeah.
I think it's been a real issue with the local districts and DOH as to how you make that actually happen.
Okay, well, the local districts and DOH can figure that out. So we want one. I'm trying to stay. Do a better job of sustaining eligibility and assuring eligibility. That'd be one recommendation.
A second problem in this regard has to do with people who sort of go in and out of the upper ranges of Medicaid income eligibility. So they're in for a while and then they're out, which means going forward, they're going to switch over to an exchange benefit. And so there's a fair number of people who are going to go between the exchange benefit and the Medicaid benefit. Now, this was actually discovered in Massachusetts, where I think there were 9,000 people a month who were churning. And so I am not smart enough to figure out the answer to this problem, but I will say we can identify this problem and two principles that ought to be applied, or maybe three principles. One is continuity of treatment and provider if you go between benefits. And it's implied by the first, is an adequate benefit in the exchange program so that essential services are going to be available to people. Those would be the two, you know, and there's two things that I'd recommend in addition to just sort of general attention to the problem. There may be some other solutions.
Mike, where does Medicaid buy-in come into that whole?
Don't even go there. I mean, it's just, yes, in theory, it ought to apply, and, you know, that's another whole. Maybe if we get it universally implemented, this would be a problem. But it's not really Medicaid buy-in is relevant for people who have. I'm not sure it's that relevant for people that are, say, TANF eligibles and go in and out of income eligibility. So anyway, John.
Mike, I'd like to suggest, and I think this ties together a couple of the conversations we've had thus far, is we pay attention to the home part of health home for a moment, and that we sort of say something about where a person is sort of most likely to get healthy. So, for instance, if somebody, and this is now thinking about those health homes which are in this round one with a heavy emphasis on behavioral health, if somebody is seriously persistently mentally ill or somebody has a substance use disorder and is currently engaged in some sort of a long-term clinical relationship, which would on some level be their sort of self-selected home, that there should be some provision given in the assignment of health home that that person can remain with their primary care, the primary behavioral health care provider in whatever health home that care provider might be associated with. Second is that as people...
That's the client preference or provider preference? That's
client preference. Client preference. If the client was engaged with a service provider and wanted to stay there, they shouldn't be forced by the state to go someplace else and disrupt their whole clinical relationship.
Well, I think my understanding of the way this is going to work, that should not be a problem because people, they ought to probably get assigned to the health home that provider is participating
right.
in, number one.
Right.
But if
they,
number two, they don't, they can you know,
opt out. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so by emphasizing the home aspect of this, I think it also gets at the issues that you raised, and it's similar to your comments, would be that there should be a default setting that if somebody moves in or out, they move back home, wherever that was. I mean, and again, you know, if there's a switch that gets tripped relative to the client. So if I get arrested, you know, and again, what I would submit is that, you know, folks around this table and the behavioral health table are somewhat comfortable working with criminal justice folks. We have a lot of them that are in our systems. And what we would want to make sure is that there was almost a sort of recognition of the expertise of those providers, you know, to sort of continue to have some responsibility for following those people when they kind of came and went out. There would have to be some mechanism there. But just the whole interface with criminal justice, making sure that the clinical, there was more of an emphasis on the level of care determination, which we talked about earlier, so that courts aren't arbitrarily making level of care determinations that are not connected with a clinical implication. But then once that's done, if people are moving in and out of the system, on and off parole and probation, all of that kind of thing, if we emphasize that they have a home, you know, and they've been assigned someplace and there's a sort of a willingness of them to continue to participate, they wouldn't be uprooted from any of those relationships.
Well,
very similar to how we sort of go to our family physician every once in a while.
So let me do this. I think what we should do is we should find the appropriate place to plug this concern around the interface with the criminal justice system and have get some more expertise on with recommendations around that and make sure we have some concrete recommendations on that. It's obviously a complex area. We don't want to get some good thoughts here, but I think we also have to be mindful of everything on the agenda so that we can solve it fully.
Yeah, but also rooted in the point that you made that we don't want people sort of moving in and out and all over the place. If we can, if there's a way of establishing a home for them.
More continuity is better.
Yeah.
Except that I would separate out the prison health piece from the care issues because I think it stands out on its own.
Place on the outside.
And it really isn't. Doesn't really fall into the same. I mean, the principles do, but the facts don't necessarily.
Okay, so we are. We're trying to move
Kelly,
on here.
So
but,
let's just give Kelly the last. Yeah. Thank you.
Very quickly, and please you're not like I'm going to be short. Consistent with what Phil was saying with the impact of criminal justice on LGU, I'd like us also to keep in mind where the FOA programs that the counties run operate now in terms of single point of entry, things like that. On the adult side, I mean, the kids' side is being taken care of separately. But in terms of those programs that are well-established and have resources in the community and know where the resources are from housing to other services, two things I think we need to keep those in mind in terms of where those fit best and serve from the health home side, which we've been talking a lot about, and also the recognition that SPO and those other programs serve a significant percentage of people who are not Medicaid eligible. So they're serving Medicare-only, third-party insurance, self-insured, and that resource needs to make sure that it stays intact, but it also, I think, brings a lot to the health home piece as well. So we'll need to keep that in mind as well, and we can provide additional information as we're talking through it among our LGUs. Thank you.
Okay.
Good.
Yeah, very good. So, Kristen, kids?
Yep. We'll try to make this as succinct as I can. So several things. What you had tasked our group to do, and by the way, thank you for giving us the leadership of Gail Nayewitz. She's just been fantastic to work with, and I think I speak for the committee in saying she's just done a marvelous job in keeping us on task. So we had two tasks. One was to do recommendations around the kids' second phase of the BHO by September. We had said September 15th, Mike. I think your next meeting is September 12th, so we'll make sure we have something substantive to you by the 12th to meet that requirement. Also to look at health homes for children by the end of the year. We've had three meetings to date. We meet nearly all day, so any rumors that you hear from people sitting around this table are true. What we have done that I think has helped us, and I just share this, that has helped us focus, is to really look at advancing what I would call crisp recommendations from a panel of experts to those who are going to take on the design in detail. So rather than trying to figure out all of the acronyms of ACOs, BHOs, SNPs, all of the rest of that, we're really trying to focus on what those core elements would be from the panel of experts. So far, we have a one-page statement of core beliefs and operational frameworks that can help to evaluate elements. And then we have recommendations really in three areas. One is to really capitalize on this opportunity to improve the design of the children's delivery system and really reduce silos. And I think you'll be very pleased to see some of what I think are very creative, courageous recommendations that are coming out, particularly related to kids in the area of the foster care and juvenile justice and the interface with behavioral health services. The other is to look at simplifying some of the complexity around kids and families. So we're looking at two sets of recommendations, one around Medicaid, around Child Health Plus, health exchanges, commercial insurance, sort of that basic behavioral health benefit. The second would be to look at the key elements of a specialty Medicaid managed care component. And we're looking at those, which really fits nicely with your template in the areas of population, access, covered services, medical necessity, provider network outcomes, and payments. So we'll have a structure for both the sort of the mainstream basic plans and the specialty plan in our recommendations. Another piece that the group has seen is that we really do think that our greatest potential to create change will be realized if we anchor our recommendations with some real strong outcomes.
You all see that?
Building shaking.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool.
Cool. Yeah, our work is so good, it makes the earth move. So,
does that happen generally in the school?
A little minor tremor here.
Right here.
That's really weird.
It's doing it again.
Yeah.
It's still going on.
Well, congratulations.
So much for, yeah. So much for my ability to keep your attention.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
I think someone was
right.
That's what I was on the floor.
Sorry.
We're good.
All right. Yeah. Everybody ready now?
Yeah.
Okay. So the... In terms of anchoring our work in outcomes, one of our participants, Dr. Glenn Sachs, is helping us look at some very robust, and again, I think these will be pretty innovative outcomes that he's tasked us to look at these to measure, not process. They need to be easy to measure, valid, reliable tools. So we'll include that in our recommendations as well. We have two more meetings that will achieve these results, and we'll get something to you again by September 12th. Any questions, any comments?
So I think from what I've heard from some people on the group, it's great work. So let me ask you a question. Has the issue about health electronic health information exchange and privacy and consent?
Mm-hmm.
Come up, and it's really the model on the adult side to incorporate that and use that really as a proxy for co-locating or for bettering communication. But it seems so much more complex on the children's side. Is that true, and what have you been thinking about?
Yeah, we've talked about that. I think the core piece that again, I bring you back to the level that we're looking at. We're working very hard to stay at a level of what's the general guidance, what's the direction, what's the theme that we want to say about that versus what exactly is it going to look like in this acronym or this program. So we have said that it's a very important piece, that access to that information, that ease of being able to make sure that kids don't get stuck when they move between systems or between services is really critical for kids, and that we have issues in terms of that we need to look at around consent and around, you know, electronic medical records. So that has been, you know, generally discussed as well.
Because I think to some extent the consent and issue is pretty poor as well.
Okay. Any other questions?
And magnitude 5.0 earthquake shook New York.
Yeah, New York City is getting it too, as we speak.
Well,
for those who think you're safe on the Christmas, you are fascinating.
Well, Harvey, do you remember anything I said?
Do you remember anything I said?
I thought you did a great job, and I thought you did an excellent job in representing the children's rights and protecting them. I would like to see the exact same thing happening for the peers in general, for the adult side, because what you did was very, very good.
I thought Harvey was supposed to take care of that.
There is a coalition of peers to protect that integrity, and that should be, you know, the group that is sought for the recommendation to protect the rights of peers and adult in the adult system.
And they have plugged in to the other group?
I will check on it, but I know that group has worked diligently over the last 6 or 8 months in preparing a whole idea around a suggestion for the Medicaid redesign health homes and is, I mean, I can hand it out right now. It's here. And also just what the basic rights are, what people, you know, what we're looking at here in regards to protecting people's rights when we're talking about Medicaid redesign. I'll be happy to hand them out. Okay.
Good. Thanks, Kristen. And we'll see if the discussion related to or coming out of the mental health criminal justice review and follow-up is similarly earth-shaking. You set a high standard here, Bob. So
I'm looking for a 7, actually.
I think the way that we'll do this presentation is that Bob and Adam will we'll lead on this, and then Tom Smith, who worked on this, is here as well. There are questions.
The purpose of presenting this now is to get information out to the group and a discussion going about what we really learned from the care monitoring initiative and the importance of engagement, the importance of using data to identify individuals that may have fallen out of care, and then finally the importance of then determining who of those individuals may be at risk and assertively engaging them, and how what we learned from this could inform the recommendations we want to make in this process. So many of you know, 2007, 2008, there were a series of very serious incidents in New York City, and the decision between the governor and the mayor's office was to set up a mental health criminal justice panel to kind of look at this and look at what we could learn from it and make recommendations to try to avoid this going forward. Very briefly, the three incidents were an individual in the Upper East Side stabbed a therapist, and the person was killed. The individual was very delusional, was worried about his mother. Another incident, somebody in Midtown went to a restaurant and took a knife and went out in the street and stabbed a passerby, and then that individual was shot by a passerby. No one was killed there, but people were seriously injured. And the third case was a an 18-year-old individual was shot and killed by the police. The person had come out of the juvenile justice system recently. The plan of care was never put in place. The individual was on a rooftop with a hairbrush, and the police thought it was a gun, and the person was shot. So the first thing that the panel really wanted to do was to really educate themselves on what the research was showing about violence and mental illness. And one source to use was the MacArthur study on violence and mental illness. So what they learned was that people with serious mental illness that don't have a substance abuse disorder, the incidence of violence for people that released from state hospitals is only slightly higher than the general population. If you look at the general population, if substance abuse is involved in the general population, you have a higher incidence of violence, and in the mental health population, that incidence of violence doubles if you have somebody that has mental illness and substance abuse. But then the MacArthur study dug further than that, and they found that for people with mental illness that are engaged in treatment, the incidence of violence is only about 2.9%. Whereas for individuals that are engaged in treatment, it's about 14%. So I think what this really says is that when you have substance abuse involved with mental illness, you have to be particularly vigilant. And the data shows that if people are engaged in care, you could dramatically reduce the potential for violence there. So then what we did was we looked at the Medicaid data for these three cases. And I remember the day that the Medicaid, we're now facile enough with Medicaid data where we could actually call up an individual case and get all the Medicaid claims data. I remember the day that the first one of these cases hit my computer screen and I was just scanning the data and my eyes got bigger and you could actually see the person becoming more ill, you could see the person falling out of care, you could see the desperation on the part of the individual getting prescriptions at emergency rooms and not having any ambulatory care, and then this incident occurred. And what it really said was the person was appropriately engaged at one point, did have the right level of services, but those services were never delivered on a consistent basis, and there was no attempts to engage the individual. What we did here, because of HIPAA, was we kind of came up with a compilation of the three cases. What this really shows is an individual who was hospitalized, and then each one of these vertical bars is a month, so this goes over a few-year period. Individual was hospitalized a couple of times. When they came out the second time, they were engaged in a partial hospitalization program, very intensive outpatient program, day treatment. Then they were hospitalized again. When they came out, they were hooked up with a clinic and case management. And the dots along the bottom, the ones that are filled in, the dark dots, all the dots are scheduled outpatient appointments. The dark dots are outpatient appointments that were kept. So you can see, and it was never very good, but it really got worse over time, and towards the end, there was hardly any contact. The fact that this individual had been hospitalized several times, had a case manager too, the question was, why wasn't there more done to engage the individual? The patterns we saw, and as we do this on all high visibility cases where there's violence or media attention, the pattern is very similar. People aren't properly engaged in care, even though they're maybe connected with the proper level of care. This is just a background on one of the individuals that, you know, was evacuated off to that confidentiality, but the person had non-adherence to care. When they were hospitalized, their symptoms were stabilized, but when they came out of the hospital, they would tend to deteriorate and cycle back. The community programs that the person was hooked up, although they were intensive, they failed to deliver the intensive care. The programs weren't very compliant with the standards of care. The programs had been cited for this in the past and hadn't made the corrective action plans to improve their delivery of care. Even though the individual was somebody that had been identified as a client of concern, there was no offer of assertive engagement. The person had substance abuse problem. There was no integrated treatment provided to the individual. And care wasn't stepped up when the individual started to have problems. So in looking at all this, the Mental Health Criminal Justice Panel had some findings and made some recommendations. And the findings were pretty much what I had said. In many of these circumstances, there's poor coordination of care, there's fragmented oversight, and there's lack of provider accountability for high-need individuals. Those were very solid findings. And there's inconsistent quality of outreach and engagement by providers, and there's limited capacity to share information across mental health and criminal justice. So the panel made some recommendations, and they made a recommendation about issuing standards of care. So there's actually an appendix in the report about standards of care, and we're actually using those standards of care as guidance as we do our licensing visits for our programs out there. And actually, if you look at the standards of care and you look at some of the recommendations that this group has already made intuitively, you've put a lot of those recommendations into what our report will be. But another part of this, and I think the part that Adam's going to describe, is that there was a recommendation that we create a care monitoring teams for high-need consumers and that we use data to track service use and flag. So what we're going to talk about now is we did actually set up the care monitoring initiative. We have a contract with an organization that's doing that in New York City. And Adam's going to talk about what we've learned there and also, you know, where we think we can go from there.
So the basic design of this activity, the Care Monitoring Initiative, as Bob said, is to use the Medicaid claims file as a way to identify a pattern of care or lack of care that reflects the need for a more intensive engagement or effort to reengage the consumer. And we focused on, and this is the first bullet, a group of consumers that we felt that we can identify from the Medicaid claims that would potentially be at risk for falling out of care, for needing this increased engagement. Those who had previously been on an AOT order, who had received ACT or case management services, had been in the state forensic system, who had had some pattern of utilization of inpatient or ER visits that might put them, you know, be something that defined them as someone that needed to be followed more closely. We took these cohorts then of folks identified through these criteria and then followed them in the Medicaid claims file for the second bullet findings, namely no recent medication fills, all of which identify someone potentially, you know, out of care or disengaged from care. And importantly, it's not only the presence of something, the presence of multiple inpatient or ER visits, but the absence of something. So no recent scripts filled, no recent outpatient visits. And that sort of highlights that utilization can go both ways in terms of defining a high-need individual, too much or too little. And then based on that data, the care monitors, the actual staff of the program, would reach out to providers, engage providers, to try to talk about how to re-engage, to do outreach and re-engage these consumers. So that's the basic design of the program. So here's some data from this, from a year's worth of work. We started the program in Brooklyn, subsequently expanded to the Bronx, and eventually citywide. The first bullet just shows how many folks we defined in that initial cohort as those that we would follow to see if there was patterns of disengagement. We define a group, a cohort of about 13,000 people, and you can see that a substantial proportion of them met one of those notification, one of those flags. Three quarters of them, in fact. So right there is an indication of sort of the extent of this problem of disengagement or potential problem. And then here's some lessons that we get of the group of people that had met these notifications. Some large proportion of them, over 40%, really didn't even have enough information in the file to allow our project staff to do some follow-up and actually try to work to re-engage them. In addition, the second sub-bullet here talks about how, given the complexities of the care that they were receiving, there were limitations based on confidentiality and other restrictions. For example, someone being served in one, say the mental health system, but also being served in the substance use system, and not being able to share that information was a limitation in how we can compile a case review and then outreach to the providers to actually try to intervene. So that was a limitation. I mean, in some cases, you know, because again, this was a provider-based initiative. In some cases, providers were not particularly responsive to the staff. So right off the bat, there were some challenges in doing this work. But of the several thousand people that we were able to do some further investigation and do some review of their case, we found the following results: that a substantial proportion, over half, had some pattern of care or lack of care that we felt was sufficient to warrant some sort of intervention. Concerns about the level of engagement, the pattern of high utilization of inpatient or outpatient or ER, or the lack of engagement that really would push for some further intervention. About a quarter, 22% of the cases were sort of false. You know, the data was not. The reality wasn't exactly what the data seemed to be telling us. So that's sort of expected that some proportion wouldn't be. And then another quarter were sort of not quite as high concern, but it seemed like maybe there were some problems, but they were being addressed. So again, you know, of the, you know, some substantial portion that we couldn't even complete a review, but of the many thousands that we did, a substantial portion really revealed some problem with their level of engagement in the system or the quality of their or the continuity of their care.
Mm-hmm.
So of that group, that 2388, right there, that 55%, here's what we found when we continued to try to investigate and to re-engage. Again, almost half of them, despite the best efforts of our care monitors and our staff, it really wasn't possible to identify an accountable provider who we could work with in order to try to re-engage our local client. That really, there was a level of disengagement and sort of lack of contact with the system that there really wasn't anyone to work with, frankly. In some substantial portion, of course, maybe not so surprising to some, but some substantial proportion were actually incarcerated. We're not, their disengagement was the result of that. And about a third, there was an identified service provider. There was an accountable outpatient clinic or case management program, and that we could work with in order to try. You know, the pattern was still there. This was a high concern individual, but there was a partner that we could work with the care monitoring team could work with in order to try to reengage the individual. Those were the main findings through the working of these cases, initially through the Medicaid, initially a data-driven approach, and then phone calls and outreach to service providers, what we found. So some of the lessons just from that experience. Clearly, you know, data and the Medicaid claims data is an invaluable resource to identify individuals who have high service needs and to display patterns and who need outreach and engagement. Do you want to wait
so
till the end, or is this
well,
a quick?
I'll just park the thought about who gets access to Medicaid data. Okay. What? I know, but go ahead.
Yeah, let me just finish up. Many of the individuals are not engaged in adequate and appropriate services, as the data shows. There's limits on cross-system information sharing that impedes re-engagement and care coordination efforts, and that we found also that the presence of a full benefit plan in someone's care didn't necessarily affect their likelihood of displaying these disengagement patterns and being disengaged from care. So managed care isn't in and of itself a prevention for this sort of pattern. So that leaves us with sort of this question that, you know, of strategies and approaches for re-engagement and for prevention of disengagement. Just end with just a few notes about sort of the success of this particular approach. Were we able, through the engagement of providers via care monitoring activity, to actually re-engage folks who had dropped out of care? You see here, this is a sort of a basic, survival curve. And that, on the y-axis is the proportion not engaged. So starting from this group of people that display this pattern of disengagement over the course of 240 days, so that's what, 8 months. The proportion of people that actually, we were able to follow up and get, and find that they were truly re-engaged in care was relatively small. Right, only 20-25%.
And this is what they were folks who fallen through the cracks.
Yeah. Right. These are the folks who had fallen through the cracks and then didn't get pulled back.
Big chasm.
So only 25% came back into care within 8 months after disengagement. Again, as I said, this was a provider oriented sort of telephone consultation and outreach approach. So clearly that particular approach was not in and of itself successful in prompting or in producing. So this is a sort of stylized vision of what a more accountable system that focuses on re-engagement would produce. I think this is Tom's depiction of a safety net.
Nice.
Yeah. Bob started the conversation with some of the more troubling cases. This is, so there wasn't a lot of success at re-engagement. There were some good successes, and this is a case of someone who had schizophrenia co-occurring, substance use disorder, had, met all three of those indicators of disengagement. No outpatient services, no meds, filled, and lots of ER and inpatient use, lots of hospitalizations. There have been a lot of discharge plans, obviously, a lot of referrals to services that didn't get fulfilled. Through the efforts of case conferencing and working with hospitals, there was the process succeeded in connecting this person to an ACT team. And then there's been good results so far. So this is sort of an example of what we'd like to see in a much more robust fashion. So there's a lot of lessons that I'm sure you all pick up from this, but clearly starting with the data is a critical tool. What comes next about finding and holding the system accountable is the challenge for us.
So let me just make a couple of comments on this. Just these things may be obvious, but may not be. One of the things that I think is something that Bob and Adam didn't explicitly comment on, but I think it's good in a sense that the safety net picture at the end here doesn't posit that everyone who is disengaged must be reengaged. Or to put it differently, there are some people who disengage for whom that's fine. And so, we're focused on the people that don't, as I think we should be, because we have an affirmative responsibility there. But, going all the way back to these slides, there are some people who are disengaged, and when the project would call up the provider knew that they were disengaged, was in contact with them, and, was like, it's okay. We have confidence that this is going to be all right. So that's a one point that I wanted to make. And I can't remember what the other point was. So, Pam, you had a comment.
I know what we have access to and what we don't, but how widespread? Who can get access to?
So one of the questions going forward is the big question is maybe two questions. One is how can we take advantage of these things that are emergent, whether it's health homes or whether it's interim BHOs or particularly
full bore, you know, care management to address this problem by some version of empowered follow-up, you know, to keep people engaged.
And
accountability, right. Because it turned out sort of, in a sense, there are two robust findings from this effort. One is the team could very reliably identify people that had dropped out. So the data are adequate to do that. But the data and a phone call, and an unempowered phone call, are not enough. So I guess that's one question that we ought to think. And I think we've already talked about a lot of that. We're already assuming accountability, you know, but that's one question. The second question is, it's in the presentation here, how do we get these individuals back in care, or sort of what are the other grounded recommendations that could be made at this time that would help fill in the chasm or resolve the problem? So I don't know, just sort of, I don't want to start with you.
I have to say that. The information, I mean, given the age of technology and everything else, so much information can be put out there, not just about the people we serve, but remember about each of us around this table as well. And I think we ought to tread very lightly in not abusing, you know, the power we have to, you know, go against someone's rights and HIPAA. I mean, the reality is for 20 years, Bill Anthony started way back when, talking about the relationship is what makes the difference in people's recovery. And now we're talking about, we've said it all here, it was all said, Adam presented it very well, that it was system failure. And now we're going to say, okay, well, let's forget about somebody's rights and let's find out if they're filling their meds, if they're not going to a treatment. The people who are providing services should have this information if they're doing it right and being in a place of having a relationship with the person. Who are people visiting the person? Do they have their email address? Do they text them? Do they, you know, send the doc out once every, you know, blue moon to just do a quick home visit? No, because the money's not there. I get all of that. But if we were to really look at what doesn't work for people in their recovery, and challenge how we're providing services, we're going to be back at this table trying to keep saving money because people who are high need are still going to go out.
So,
rights I'm worried about. It's having everybody's business.
Let me take you to something other than a speech. You know, your speech is deeply felt.
Please.
And you know, so can you take us to the statement that you gave us before? From the coalition, Ellen, could you suggest ways in which these proposals might be relevant to this problem? And I didn't really answer Pam's question, so I want to come back to that in a second.
Let me try to take a crack at some of that.
Okay.
First of all, I just want to say just a little speech, too, is I remember when these episodes of violence happened. I was so grateful to the city and the state for not playing into the papers and all the round them up, lock them up, more forced treatment. Was a really commendable direction you went into. I agree with Ellen. You looked at system failure, not patient failure, which we've historically done. Mike, I guess some of the things, first of all, I would say that a lot of the, I remember when you and Lloyd made these presentations, housing instability was a big factor for a lot of these people in the cohort that you had. You would look at, I remember you saying that down in the city.
It's not as big a factor as some of these other issues, but it can be a factor.
I just want to point that out, that certainly,
right.
Linking housing and harm reduction, the approach that Pathways to Housing, for example, uses, they're engaging in the same cohort as Kendra's Law, and starting where people are, offering them what they need, which is not always where to start a relationship is with medicine or clinic treatment, but it may be housing, it may be food, it may be just, you know, really sort of core level. So starting where a person is, looking at the immediate needs, I think certainly peer support, starting with the relationship, really, again, paying attention to where people are at and trying to involve them in care are places to start.
Okay. So let me sort of go back, though.
Mm-hmm.
How should we use this stuff that you've given us to solve this problem?
Well, I think on...
Can we, or is it not really about that, and should we just move on?
No, I think on one thing is to really you know, give warning that we do not allow a global release of information.
Okay, so let me just sort of come back to this.
Mm-hmm.
The rules under which data sharing is permissible
mm-hmm.
are the existing state and federal rules. Period.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that defines how this information can and should be used. So HIPAA applies, and the substance abuse rules apply. What I'm looking for, you know, is, you know, sort of concrete suggestions that might assist with this problem from the thing that you put before us.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help us with that or not?
Yeah. You know what, Mike, I will agree. What I will do is this. I will come back by email with you by the end of the week to the whole group and put this into a more formidable statement.
Okay. So just, you know, the... What
and operationalize it, absolutely.
So what I, you know, that's, and let me ask you to do that
mm-hmm.
and to pitch to us recommendations that should be implemented that can be implemented. So we're not, you know, we're not looking for nirvana here, but we're looking for grounded recommendations that can help solve this problem. So, you know, I think we know, for example, that for some people who are in distress, who have histories with the system, they are much more likely to see somebody or go into a place that is not imaged as a professional place but is imaged as a peer place.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, what recommendation would you make for us about that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let me just sort of park that and come back to John in a second, but sort of Pam, to go to what you're saying about data. So there are, in a sense, there are two or three opportunities related to data that are sort of before us right now. So one of those opportunities is that the core sort of methodology that enabled a review of this claims information that was actually used by the team in Brooklyn is essentially a modification of our psyche's data. So, the principle there is for somebody who is taking care of somebody,
yeah.
there's the ability to look at their data on service utilization, and also under HIPAA, for entities that are paying for care, there is the ability to look at data to relate to, you know, to the paying for accountable care. And so with health homes and with BHOs, there's going to be the ability to look responsibly at data for people that are enrolled in care, to use that data for the purposes of, you know, providing care, and secondly, so this is a general and a long range statement, but what we're also intending, this is not fully baked yet, but what we're intending to do in the interim VHO process that will be underway, you know, at some point in the next few months, is to work with the selected entities and to work with provider organizations to make these capabilities available and to start using them to try to improve continuity of care even before we get into a full care management kind of environment. So that's, you know, that's a little general, but we see significant opportunities for that. John,
one quick thing is also that, you know, as RIOs and other technologies for health information exchange emerge in the state, and, you know, there are working within, as Mike said, the legal, you know, parameters, there's a lot of policy and operational issues to be worked through around the inclusion of behavioral health
mm-hmm.
information in standard exchange documents
right.
and making sure that whatever consent protocols are most appropriate get operationalized in those systems, and that's another area.
Right.
Okay, John, Sanjeev, and then
Alice. So I'm thinking about the one graph that showed half of the folks with no provider and the 25% that were incarcerated. And, you know, Harvey mentioned harm reduction. It seems to me that we have to find some sort of a recommendation that specifically references harm reduction and very well may sort of tag into the whole sort of peer approach. But harm reduction has to be a part of our discussion, I think. Secondly, and again, I think, you know, and I appreciate your opening remarks when you had your meeting with with folks on the second floor, and you push back on the reinvestment thing. I think, you know, not lost on me in that graphic about the 25% is why were those folks in prison or in jail? And to what extent is simply a matter of that inadequate psychiatric and substance use disorder services? And I'm taking a wild guess that you know, 98% of the folks we're talking about are people of color. So there's a sort of, I think we have an opportunity, particularly with this administration, to push back a little bit, both on the race issue, the fact that we have a very racist system, number one, and then number two, the fact that inadequate resources result in people shifting out of a service delivery system that's inadequate into one where we can keep on building prisons. And again, I think we happen to have an environment right now that might be receptive to that end. And frankly, where some of our work might overlap with the group that's dealing with the sort of disproportionate access to services, et cetera. So again, I'm thinking that if we include something in our document that talks about the need to make sure that we have some sort of safety valve in place here to divert people away from, keep people out of the criminal justice system and more appropriately in a more of a public health model, I think that would really help. And just one other sort of concrete suggestion, and this had to do with the data piece and the medications. It might be an interesting thing to look at some sort of a recommendation about prescription monitoring. And this could be a voluntary thing. When somebody goes to have a prescription for pain medication or for a psychotropic medication, that there's some scientific implication where failure to take it or taking too much of it could cause significant problems. If a person voluntarily says, I'd be happy to get a little notice from somebody if I'm taking too much or not taking enough, there might be some way to have some sort of a voluntary preventive approach to people's use of their medications, not just for psychotropic medications, but also, you know, pain medications, where people become very addicted. You know, some folks might not realize that they're getting dependent and think it's part of, you know, their treatment process. It might be some way of building something in there.
Notwithstanding some of the issues raised about data sharing, but one of the things that we struggled with as a health plan is that we are given access to information from the state on fee-for-service claims, both for recipients, both for new enrollees, as well as existing enrollees. And one of the challenges has really been to manipulate that data in a fashion that allows it to reflect the care that has taken, that has occurred prior to the individual enrolling with us, as well as the existing providers who may be receiving services, you know, through fee-for-service. And I'm curious to know from Robert and Adam whether how easy it was to organize the information that then led you to identify individuals in terms of ER use, inpatient use. That's easy enough. In terms of providers, particularly not necessarily primary care providers, but case management or targeted case management or other CBOs who were accessing services, it's not so intuitive just looking at that data and identifying the buckets in which each of these categories fall into. And to your point about pharmacy, I mean, even mundane things like identifying the dispensing pharmacy and trying to make some connection with the pharmacist, it's not so easy from the pharmacy data that we receive to do that. Often if it's a chain pharmacy, it's often hard to pinpoint which exact location the medication was dispensed from. And I think as data sharing evolves, it is worth recognizing the fact that the ability to get data in a much more concrete fashion in real time would make it easier to be reactive to the information we receive.
Yes, so I'll just make one or two comments about that. And one of those is that recognizing the difficulty of that, of those challenges, the fact that we're moving into a health home environment and we're moving into an interim BHO environment, we have to take advantage of that. And so those things should help us, number one. And number two, we have to use the the time that we're in this transitional environment to try to get better at it. So I think Allison, and then Ann and Kelly, and then maybe we should move on.
I don't want to speak for OMH, but OMH has spent years and a ton of time and effort mm-hmm. with input and feedback from providers that are utilizing this data
yeah.
right now in a very user-friendly format where you can filter and it will
mm-hmm.
give you reports and all that. My real reason for the arm up before was this: the presentation sort of, without saying it, assumes that this data is being used by providers without patient consent. And I can assure you that there are about 20 hospitals in New York City. While it is permissible under New York state privacy laws and federal privacy laws to use it in certain circumstances, the providers in the hospital setting that are using this are in every situation asking the patient for consent. And if it's an emergency, they are accessing it being an emergency route. But it is being used as a tool to actually inform care, coordinate
mm-hmm.
care, and engage consumers in participating in the care. I just wanted to mention
yep.
the whole consent piece, which has taken...
That ought to be the solution we use 99.9% of the time. Yeah.
I just would say that I think this data could be very useful to be given to providers in kind of aggregate forms and compare one to the other. They've done much more of this on the medical side, where people have compared outcomes. And I think this kind of data doesn't have to be even patient-specific, because providers often don't know where they fall in terms of how many disengaged patients they have. Maybe we should, but they don't. And I think when you can have that kind of aggregate data going out, you then get a dialogue going, and you actually move change.
Well, that, in a sense, history is overtaking us in this regard, because we've just gotten to a place, the project in that's in Brooklyn and the Bronx, so starting to do that. And then the MRT came along, and now we're moving into the BHO environment. So, what we'll do, I think, is we'll commit to continuing that kind of a process in this interim environment to see, you know, how much better we can get. And then when we move into a fully at-risk environment, we can do even more.
And then one other thing I think that is learned when you look at this is that providers, if you're going to treat the seriously mentally ill, you have to have access to certain kinds of services that some of us have not traditionally had, like peer support services, outreach, foot-on-the-ground services, not telephone calls. And I think just mandating to some extent that you have to have a certain capacity for that if you're going to treat this population should probably be said in a stronger way that actually requires people to do it.
I think we have a near consensus on that, or we have an unexpressed or a semi-expressed consensus that you're helping to articulate, and sort of we'll wait to see what Ellen's going to come back and, you know,
right.
basically what I'm thinking is inform that perspective and give us some more operational recommendations that might help illuminate that. Kelly, you had something before?
Very quickly, I just wanted to point out two observations and also a nod to how important the psychic state is. But on slide 13, when they're talking about the length of time for engagement, I have my line here with 3 months, because that's where the way the health home piece is structured and looking now that at that point a health home would be able to get paid for doing that outreach and engagement piece, and that we still have this other group that we need to think about too. In fact, I was talking with a DCS today who comes from a relatively small county. Her SPOA coordinator had been working with a client who was lost to care, called the person 5 times, he hung up on her 5 times, and they have a longstanding relationship. He ultimately called back, apologized, you know, whatever the process went forward, they got him back into care, but this is something where you have a good, solid relationship, things you need to keep in place. Secondly, Bob, I just want to tell you how pleased the counties are to have the high utilizer data on psyches. Another DCS had mentioned today, too, that once that was on there, you could see a bigger picture of a specific patient who they had been watching, who had gone to a number of different pharmacies that they had not been able to see before. You could see the whole pattern of, you know, prescription seeking, things like that. The counties are using it. Thank you. It's working well.
So we're sort of getting better at doing this on the one hand, and we have these opportunities before us on the other. But, you know, sort of we know we have to do better, as measured by the very substantial number of people with a very high concern for their well-being and the well-being of others who are known to have those characteristics, are engaged in care, drop out, and then after a relatively brief period of time, nobody can be identified who is, you know, working with or in touch with them. So we've got to do a lot better on this. Okay. Good conversation. It's compressed because of the time. We've got some good follow-up and some good initial ideas. So we want to turn now to presentation that I think, Susan, you're going to try to summarize what we know about and what you're recommending we should be doing with respect to performance monitoring?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, measurement and monitoring. So thank you. I'm delighted to be here today. And it speaks to my roots in many ways. I lived in L.A. for many years and will acknowledge that I'm here still trembling a bit after the building. I'm having kids in D.C. But more importantly, this theme of measuring performance and the promise and perils of managed care goes back more than 20 years with me. Back in 1990, I was, of course, a child then. IBM was the first major U.S. company, major company, to carve out its behavioral health benefits to a managed care vendor, a behavioral health managed care vendor. And overnight, that vendor doubled the number of covered lives it managed. That's how small the industry was then, that a company with, say, 250,000 people would represent over half of a company's business. Today, for the large companies, a company that size would represent less than 1% of the business. And so what that means is that 20 years ago, this nascent industry was starting to grow, and there was a quick rush to carve out your behavioral health care benefits because of the huge cost savings that were associated with doing so. And those cost savings came largely from the greatly reduced fees that providers were paid under managed care contracts. And that was the private sector side. And IBM, when it did this carve-out, created a mental health advisory board to a five-person board that I've sat on since that founding to help monitor the vendor, watch the vendor, create performance standards. And as the vendors have grown, they have become large enough to take on public sector contracts. Look at the size of the contracts we will be, or the number of lives coming under the contracts in New York State. And so it's a very different management challenge in that public sector rates cannot have that kind of depression that we saw in private sector. So the opportunities, the challenges, whatever verb you or adjective you describe to them, are different within the public sector. And all of the stories that we heard about earlier today sort of are those things that we want to use performance measuring to align incentives for better care within the system. So that's the preamble to this talk today. And I'd like to go through what are our principles here. The principles, I would say, are, you know, good care is accessible, acceptable, and appropriate. This is, and the goal of good care is good outcomes. None of this, you know, the operation was a success, but the patient died. And so let's go through those terms one at a time and try to say what we're going to mean by them. Accessible care. Accessible means available to you in your community. I need something near where I live, where I work, that I can get to. I don't have to leave work to do so. Acceptable care. No, don't ask me to leave work. Acceptable means it's offered in such a manner. That means I need my provider to speak the language I speak. I need the appointment to be at a time where I don't have to get a sitter for my kids or whatever else. And that it's somebody I want to sit and spend time with, and that helps me have my plan to get where I want to go. Appropriate care. Appropriate means doing the right thing. That means that the care is evidence-based, informed by evidence. It's not, random. I should have confidence that the provider I'm coming to, that the payer is paying because that provider has expertise in what I need. And that it's individualized. What you get and what I get are different. And that it's implemented correctly. which means that the provider has a way of saying this is implemented with high enough fidelity that we can expect to get the outcomes typically associated with such an intervention. And that it's timely that if I've just left this, we're going to talk a lot about what happens to somebody after a psychiatric hospitalization, and I better have offered to me acceptable, a timely appointment right away, and that the time from that first appointment to my next appointment is also really reasonable. This is about engaging people who need services in appropriate, acceptable care. And what do we mean by good outcomes? Well, recovery, that I get on the track that I want to be on, resiliency, recovery, this is the theme. This is like numbers 1 through 20. We can go on, and we also have disease-specific measures, plus, this return to good functioning, that if I'm depressed, my PHQ-9 score should be, within a certain range. If I'm psychotic, my symptoms should have subsided to a point where it lets me go back to school, to work, to what good functioning is for me. And sometimes for good outcomes, we use no bad outcomes as a proxy, that I haven't been readmitted, that I'm not drinking again, that I'm not homeless. And we all need to recognize that good outcomes are influenced by factors in addition to the proximal treatment. So now that last part of that definition way at the beginning of this talk, what do we mean by reasonable cost? Oops, we don't mean that. When you don't know what the right amount is, a clue that you're sending may be off is if you either lead the pack or bring up the rear. So in many of these measures we'll be talking about today, we don't know what the right number is, but it's important to know the landscape so that you can look at each of the tails and say, is there a problem here or is there a success story here that we need to, learn from? And we'll show you some of the landscape. And the payment systems need to recognize that some people cost more to treat than others and compensate accordingly. And that depends on what the rules are that come out, like for health homes or for any system that involves some level of capitation. If I'm, hospitalized for depression and I'm being discharged to a spouse and a job, the effort around me is likely going to be different to make sure I get engaged in appropriate care than somebody who was hospitalized for schizophrenia and is not housed and has no other social support. We got to pay providers fairly for what we're asking them to do, and case mix matters. So what's reasonable cost? Again, the payment system should minimize the potential for adverse selection. If I'm, a pregnant woman who's HIV positive and has schizophrenia, it's not okay for, who shall I pick on, it, for Ann to say, Susan, I will gladly serve you, but, I just want to let you know that Phil down here, he has a clinic that's really good for women like you. So just to be aware of the potential for skimming and dumping in all of the different payment rules set up different potentials for that. Once we know the rules, then we pick what we measure around. And we create incentives to titrate treatment. A good payment system creates incentives to titrate treatment to ensure that costs are reasonable for the circumstances at hand. We want to avoid both incentives to under or over treat. And so government's job, what's government's job? It includes knowing whether it's getting good value for taxpayer dollars. And so that means knowing whether we're getting good value for healthcare dollars by tracking accessibility, acceptability, appropriateness, outcomes, and costs, these domains. So We need to provide that information to support clear and accountable leadership. As patients, we want treatments that are best for recovery. I want evidence-based treatments for myself, for my kids, for my neighbors who are asking me for referrals. As payers, we want health expenditures to stretch as far as possible and to produce good value and to be spent on effective treatments. Since it's reasonable to ask administrators at BHOs, NCOs, hospitals, state or local government, or unit chiefs, how do you ensure that your practitioners are using best practices and achieving the desired results? And how do you know that this is true? It's one thing to say ACT team on the door. It's another thing to, you know, have it be that way. I once visited an ACT team that said, yeah, you know, we love the ACT model. We love it. And we've done what we need to tune it to local circumstances. You know, so for us, we do work 9 to 5 Monday through Friday and have found it more convenient for clients to come to us. You know, you get the picture. So it doesn't matter what it says on the door. It matters what happens on the floor. All right. So that was the setup to some examples then of performance monitoring and measurement. And these examples are going to be, let's go to why we need it. You know, when squeezed, the toothpaste doesn't always come out of the front of the tube. You know, we certainly saw this in the care monitoring initiative. We thought, you know, that initiative was a huge success in that it, for a particular cohort of vulnerable individuals, were able to use claims data to identify people who needed care who appeared to be disengaged in care. You know, very successful in that. Did it actually help people return to care? No. As the survival curve you saw, the rate of reengagement was remarkably low because what happens time and again is when the care monitoring team would call the provider would say, yeah, you know, Susan was inpatient, you know, a month ago. I don't know what happened. Or, yeah, she stopped coming. I discharged her. So, you know, you learn from this, and you, in BHO world, emphasize talking with that inpatient provider while the person is still an inpatient. And effective monitoring improves care and reduces waste by allowing identification and elimination of those holes in the sides of the tube. So what makes a good measure? Well, it's got to be a good proxy for the concept, you know, to be a valid measure. It's got to create incentives for good care. It's got to be meaningful to clients, clinicians, and other stakeholders. It's got to be straightforward and reliably measured. And the goal is fair compensation for complexity of people's treatment needs. And the strategies include risk-adjusted case rates so that payment aligns with needs, incentivized integration of care to address comorbidity, offer some outlier protection so that if, you know, lots of Susans who are HIV positive and have schizophrenia and are pregnant show up, you're game to specialize in some very challenging niches while being appropriately protected from ridiculous risk. And, you know, shared risk and shared savings between the payer and the provider. And data transparency, you know, no secret rules about how that price came to be. What would performance measures look like that reflect these principles? And what would they look like for phase one of BHOs? So phase one is before risk bearing, and the performance standards that were there in the solicitation document all could be computed directly from claims data. So no ridiculously heavy lift, no chart abstraction, et cetera. So what if you know, this were your challenge to have measures that accomplish everything I've just talked about and to pull them straight from claims, from encounter data, you know, what could we look for? Well, let's take the treatment domain of access and engagement in care. And, you know, would a reasonable performance expectation be that individuals who have been ill enough to be hospitalized will be engaged in appropriate follow-up services promptly upon discharge? I mean, you know, that to me is not just, you know, that I think everybody in the room is nodding their head to that. So how would you then operationalize that performance expectation? And this actually is the way I like approaching these topics, to come up with the performance expectations that you get broad agreement on and then say, okay, what's a reasonable lift measure we could use to address that? So, you know, one metric would be that at least X percent of individuals discharged from a psychiatric hospitalization will have an outpatient visit within Y days of discharge. You know, so think about for yourself, what would you expect that X and that Y to look like? And we know there's EDIS measures, or that, you know, we often talk about what fraction would be within 7 days, what fraction would be within 30 days. You know, what should that curve look like? Let's just go straight there. Here it is. This is New York State Medicaid data, and these have never been crunched this way before. So this is a view. This is 2009 data, so very recent data for all of New York State. What you see here are for adults who were Medicaid beneficiaries. What's the news look like? So what this is, you know, goes for 180 days of time on the x-axis. And then here you see the percentage who still have not had a first outpatient visit. And so, you know, the day of discharge, nobody. But when you get down to a week, you see that 35% of people who left the hospital had an outpatient claim within, for service within 7 days. So, you know, big room for improvement there.
Straight Medicaid fee-for-service?
This is everything.
Or Medicaid.
That Medicaid pays for.
All Medicaid.
So Medicaid managed care is in there?
Encounter data in here, yes.
And by the way, plans do better than fee-for-service in this regard. There's, you know, no data on this, but this is everything. This is the state of the system.
Yeah. And so what do we count as an outpatient service? As part of the, you know, devil in the details, like, do you count showing up at the ER? You know, if you didn't get hospitalized, but no. So this is any clinic visit, any case management service.
This is an opportunity for improvement.
All right, and then by 30 days, you know, within a month, barely over half, a little over half. So big need for improvement. What's it look like for kids? You know, kids, you say there's some responsible adult around, you know, some a little bitty bit better. All right. What else would we like to look at then? Well, in the interest of time, so these are all here in your handouts, so I'll be on the website. Let's look at a measure of engagement. Like, you know, you worry that if you make a standard of you're going to have prompt first visit post-discharge, how many people have you heard that said, yeah, I got in the door, and then I had to wait forever for the next visit? You learn to study for the test. And so what does time to, we saw the time to that first visit. If you called engagement in care, what's the floor you'd be willing to say was he was engaged in care?
A different approach would be, so what's the package of outpatient care that ought to be sufficient following an episode of inpatient care? That'd be a different way to answer that, to ask the question. And, you know, and we probably all agree it's not a visit.
No. Right.
No, so.
And so what if it were as little as 6 visits in 3 months? You know, so like an average of 2 a month? That seems pretty modest. What's your guess of how often we achieve that for people discharged? 6 visits in 3 months. Let's look at it. So we have, here's the curve we already saw. The red curve is the time to the first visit. And then the green line is the time to the second visit. And you see, there's a whopping fall off between the first and second visit. And if you make it to the second visit, you're pretty likely to make it to the third and the fourth, the fifth. So here's this mustard-colored line on the top is 6 visits. So we said 6 visits in 3 months. That's 90 days. What fraction of people who were sick enough that they were hospitalized had 6 visits in 90 days? A little over 20%. So 3/4 of the people who have the life disruption, expense, et cetera, of an inpatient hospitalization are not engaged in care post-hospital. And here's what it looks like for kids, a little bit better. All right, so what does it look like for access? What might some performance? You can see that there's a lot of room for improvement and that posting data on time to, you know, 6 visits or whatever by DHO, by, you know, by region, by hospital, by whatever, lets me as the Susan of the world be a more informed consumer about which hospital I'd rather go to. And as the payer, I say, DHO number one, how is it that your stats are improving at this rate and DHO number two, you're not? So that's the world we're coming into also. So what would an example of a performance expectation around access be? Well, how about almost all individuals who were ill enough to have had a psychiatric hospitalization should receive pharmacotherapy post-discharge? You know, that if I was sick enough to be in the hospital, if I don't fill a script within 30 days, is that because the hospital put me on something that my outpatient, my health plan's formulary doesn't have on it anymore? That's going to be a new worry in the new world when the pharmacy benefits are under the health plans. Or is it that, so what does time to fill a script look like? Here it is. That we do better at filling scripts than we do at outpatient visits. And we all know that meds alone aren't enough. So I fill a script within 30 days because, you know, be generous. You don't know how many days I left the hospital with. Oh, that was a preview. It looks like about half of the people fill a script within 2 weeks of discharge. And the red line is for everybody with a diagnosis. And then the blue and green, or blue is if you had were hospitalized for a psychosis, are you filling some antipsychotic when you've been discharged, and the green is for the mood disorder. But, you know, for kids, it looks different. It looks different. If you were a youth, you know, under age 21, hospitalized for depression, your odds of filling any mood disorder or mood stabilizer or antidepressant are kind of poor, and unless you do it quickly, you don't do it. So what?
The green line
is kids.
That's because they're all getting access to really good psychotherapy.
Absolutely. Yep.
So do we know why that is?
No. And so this is a wonderful, these are fresh data. So where we've started peeling, that's just what you want to find, is something that, why is it different here? And so this is different in the bad direction, so you want to find the barriers. Sometimes you can find different in a good direction and find out, you know, how does that clinic manage to bring them in?
The good news is that we have discussed this at length in the children's behavioral health discussion for this group. So
it's
definitely a consideration, as is them just.
Great.
So, Susan, we're in trouble time-wise.
Okay.
So, you know, how do you race?
I'm not going to deal with any of the specific measures anymore. I'm going to go to the we've got outcomes measures. We've got all the phase two measures where we are expecting you to go into the chart some and say that you're going to make sure people are doing screening for depression, for substance use, things that aren't going to show up on claim status. So we're going to skip those and go to... section four, what goes wrong and how to make mid-course corrections? Because that's, you know, when you see the line is out of whack. You know, we stress your performance expectations to recognize that, this is slide 46, that...
Page 16.
that nobody gets everything right the first time. You know, care monitoring initiatives, we can name the things it was a success for. It didn't hit all the bullseyes. So performance measurement and feedback is central to this, continuous quality improvement. And uncovering problems is good news. Better to know that somehow those kids are outliers than, think it's all okay. And then we want to intervene and make sure that changes are in the right direction. So we need those baselines, we need the landscape, and we need to see how it's moving. We need the capacity to identify and measure problems, interventions, responses to interventions, and to implement improvements throughout the system of care. And we look to the current landscape when setting those performance standards. And the devil is in the details. So it speaks to the importance of transparent measurement methodology. Anybody ought to get to know what the rules are and be part of saying what a reasonable expectation is. It means we use uniform measurement algorithms across vendors to facilitate comparisons within and across vendors, regions, programs, populations. And we watch for adverse or unintended consequences and revise the standards accordingly. You know, if the time to the first visit, improving that sacrifices the time to the second visit, we notice that and build it in. So you have a phase one, BHO land phase one, where we listen, we measure, we learn from it, and we take the next steps. So on the horizon, we have enhanced attention to measuring housing, employment, recovery, the percentages of services that are EBPs, the provision of preventive services, suicide prevention activities, continuity of treatment for the most vulnerable, high-need populations, care coordination across treatment domains, and monitoring for disparities in access and outcomes. We need measures for all of this. We go through the process just like we did for engagement. The cautionary tales, we probably all have bruises. Full capitation invites underused services. You got to watch. Phantom networks. I need a psychiatrist. There's 1,000 psychiatrists in the panel. I can't get an appointment for 3 months. So where's the psychiatrist? Limits of telephonic care management, disease management. Assuming that every person has a cell phone is not a safe strategy. Perils of antiquated IT, some of the measures in phase two definitely will require the merging of data sources. Many vendors, many providers don't typically merge. And, kids are not little adults. The attention to discharge planning, for example, for kids and adults is different, and this committee, I'm sure, will go there. Vendor churn, there are lessons to be learned from, read the newspaper headlines. Any of our huge vendors have success and failure stories where you look at how often does a given payer say, I like what I have getting well enough that I'm going to re-up with you. It's not an industry with high re-upping rates.
Yeah, serial monogamy, not...
Yeah, long-term.
Right.
Buying EBP
is a problem.
Yeah. So the cautionary tales include, buying evidence-based, act on the door but not on the floor. So, I meet the letter versus the spirit of the law. I get you into the door fast, but you've got to wait for your second appointment. The pharmacy benefit management, promise and perils thereof. So the measurement approaches, contract-specific performance standards with performance monitoring, centralized provision of summaries of administrative data. OMA shall be pushing out in a very public way the performance standards for the various CHOs. Vendor-generated data aggregated centrally with sampling-based audits. You got to sniff and see if you believe what's happening. And you publish the scores, you have outlier monitoring, and transparency in the payment rules, in the measurement rules, and in performance. That's it.
Right on time. Look at that.
It's a mouthful.
So
in less than time, I caught up.
Thank
Then the question is sort of how to approach all this.
almost like reactive, Mike, if I
yeah.
could. And I have to say that I really appreciate both of us, Stevenson, really marking people's Wishful Hospital community and meditation. But, again, I feel about this the way I felt about the conversation earlier around peer services and throughout, is that a lot of the time, I did some four focus groups when we were going to at ICL with a number of people, consumers, who were about to go to managed care, and I asked them at a critical moment, at your worst moment, what did you need? And they didn't say, I want to see a clinician, I want to take my medication. They said I needed housing, food, support, advocacy, coaching, linkages, safety, warmth. They said so many things of what constitutes health, but we, being a system that focuses on meds, clinics, and hospital, you know, we have this hammer, and so everything looks like a nail to it. So
yeah.
I really loved how you got at the end on the horizon to these other things, but I think they really belong much more integrated. I think we've tried to say this in these discussions. It's not all about getting to your doctor within 7 days. It's important that people are connected, but I think we're in danger of just trying to save money from hospital emergency use and get people to take pills and go to their clinic more often, but that's only a piece of what we'll make for health.
Yeah, and I agree completely. And how can we make sure that this is part of phase one also? We know that in phase one, we'll basically have claims data to be measuring performance. And so it's not going to have the housing, the coaching, the tag that this was a peer delivering the service as part of it. So what can complement that there that we will have then? And I'm encouraged that
if we don't move quickly on it, I just fear that we're going to be all about pills and clinics.
Exactly. So what we do have, and, you know, hold our feet to the fire to make sure it stays there, is that in the specifications document that the BHOs bid on, it said, hey, you're going to be watching those discharge plans, and UBHO will be reporting back as to whether these key components of the discharge plan are attended to. And that's where you get into the housing, these other, you know, these things that make it a life for me. And that's the new lift in this. And it is still focusing on the people who are in the hospital. That is phase one.
You know, one of the things that you were talking about how, you know, that disconnect after discharge, one of the things that has been done in the criminal justice system with OMH has been putting peers in and services in the prisons. Like, we work up at Sing Sing. So we're up there for 3 months working with these guys. And then when they get released, we follow them then for 3 months in the community. And the recidivism rate had done a complete inversion since our involvement in that, from 15% to 85% stay out. So, you know, there's something to that. So I'm wondering, why wouldn't the same thing work with peers in the hospitals when people go in there to build those relationships? And when they get out, that same person is there. You know, it's not a new face. It's not a new relationship they have to build at a very scary time. I mean, my first hospitalization, it wasn't until I got home that it was the scariest, because nobody really understood me.
Yeah.
Nobody knew what I needed, and I didn't know how to say what I needed. If I met somebody in the hospital and then that same person was there, it would have been a whole different story.
And that's essential to the peer bridger model, which a number of peer programs do.
Mm-hmm. And when we look around the country to what seems the most exciting right now, it is this the use of peers in just the kinds of roles you're talking about. So what's phase two supposed to be having in it? When with capitation comes the opportunity for these services that right now don't have, you know, the billing codes for it.
Right.
And
right.
So that's why there's a phase one to get them up and going, and the entities up, and a phase two to say make
right,
it work.
But it's also that something that not necessarily gets covered under the medical necessity piece, too. So
mm-hmm.
That's another.
Right. It, suddenly, if
right.
I'm the
reinvestment.
Yeah, it is reinvestment.
There's money.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's the risk-bearing entity, then, it's in my best interest. And this is who we've seen. It's not the states that are funding the peer programs. It are the large, it's the large managed care vendors that are holding the contract.
County money.
As a trained token,
peer services like recovery coaching for individuals with addictive disorders has to be clearly in this mix. And we, mental health has had it worked out for years, but we have to make sure that the same thing is worked out and included for individuals with addictive disorders.
Yep. Although
increasingly they're emerging. I mean, our bridges
have
to be
addictions as well.
Yeah,
had it worked out for
years.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, how long has it been relatively standard in addiction recovery to have a recommendation for 12-step, you know, as a standard part of a transition?
However, that's too narrow.
I know. But it's at least it's almost always there. And it's almost always there. There'll be some kind of recommendation like that. So then you're suggesting take it to the next level.
Yeah, but it's like giving a person an appointment and he doesn't follow through. A lot of what you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I
think you're completely right in it, but I think our bridgers, which we've been doing mental health bridging for years, just recently got retrained to be about medical conditions and substance use, because you have to know all three.
Yeah.
To link people up to all the things.
I mean, that's what's coming out in all of the treatment providers as a pros. I mean, I would have to say 90% of the people we serve have the dual diagnosed issue. So, and what happens in on both ends, though, you know, mental health hospitalizations may be less interested in taking someone with a drug and alcohol problem, but the inverse is true as well.
Yeah.
Trying to get people into a rehab that have a mental health condition is very difficult too, and we got to marry the two somehow.
You know, and I agree that the co-occurring disorders that we're working on that, but there are still a high percentage of individuals who are simply have addictive disorders.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we need to meet the needs of that population.
Absolutely.
Also. It's sort of like we've got a blending in the middle, mental health, addictive disorders, and then the dual in the middle. We have to meet that whole spectrum.
Yeah, I think as we begin to measure outcomes, and outcomes should have also been part of the outcomes has to be how people feel about their own recovery, so that's a critical element, because if people feel good about themselves, then they're less likely to use ER, less likely to be hospitalized and take on different roles. So providers' behaviors, I believe, will change in that dynamic when there's more transparency, there's more benchmarking, and when we get our metrics in place. But I think the point's been made that we have to get the right set of services. I sometimes, when I hear this stuff falling through, the people fall through the cracks, it's not just about care coordination. That's a good piece of it, and we're putting a lot on care coordination to fix the system, which may or may not be able to fix the entire system. I'm not as hopeful that that's just the only missing ingredient. And the other piece is, do we have the right set of services? So some of the services that you heard, those they're not clinic services. They're not, nothing against clinics. We run one. But, you know, it's sometimes those other portals that make the most difference to someone when they come out of a hospital, when you're beginning to engage somebody. So I hope that in the mix of services, when we get to, you know, what's working and what's not, we expand our process beyond the existing service delivery, because I think that's sometimes where we miss the point that some of those, we call them safety net, you know, maybe under the redesign, maybe under a waiver, where they would be more of the type of services we can offer to individuals who really aren't really looking for that clinic visit necessarily as a portal to wellness.
Yeah, I just want to, I mean, in sort of to follow up on what Donna said a little bit, is that, you know, when we talk about engagement, you know, an engagement measure is if you see someone after your discharge within 6 days, but is that really, you know, consumer-driven engagement? I mean, how do we measure that? We have certain values that we've stated, but when we look at quality, I think we have to really think about what we want to measure and what engagement really means, both on the consumer side. And I didn't hear much about the family side on the adult side, which I think can be very important. It may not be, but that should be included. Families are involved in the lives of some of their adult children very extensively, and I think some of the differences in the prescription, you know, getting prescription filled, is that you haven't engaged the parent or a caregiver, a younger child, and, you know, if you don't engage the parent, you're not going to get good outcomes. So really think about what engaging means.
Yeah. This kind of goes back to the comment that was made earlier when you talked about the process for approving these health home applications. It seems to me that if the state agencies have a commitment to, the word robust is used a lot, but, you know, if you have these, you know, to say that in every area of the state, New York City and every other area of the state, there will be access in some of the categorical areas that were just articulated, but a very good way to break it down, but the following services will be available. I mean, and on some level, that puts us in a weird position to have to push back on some of our instructions. The simple fact of the matter is that the mental health system has been decimated, as has substance use disorder system, by budget cuts over some period of time. And so while we might talk about a continuum of services, the question that the state agencies can ask of any health home application is, do you have all of the component parts, yes or no? And if the answer is, you know, the answer is no, because there are none in that geographical area, it would seem to me then that the state of New York has a little bit of a challenge in order to make sure that we meet the standards that we're setting. So I think the agency is in a really good place, and the behavioral health, you know, folks and our recommendations, if we couch them in a commitment to that constellation of services in each region, it seems to me that it puts us in a good place to make some of this stuff happen.
Well, let me sort of say where I'm thinking about, where I'm sort of feeling this conversation has to go, because it's sort of interesting. We sort of, you know, did a very limited but kind of deep dive in some data stuff.
And that took us immediately to everything else we wanted to talk about, none of which was about the data, all of which was about deep cultural and economic and resource limits in the system of care that we now like to solve.
So this is what I think is just happening, which is just neither good nor bad. It's just like, so this is what's happening in the conversation. So here's my thought about that. What's that, Harvey?
That's how we keep people out of hospital and emergency. If we address those things more.
Well, that might be true. And that and $1.50 will, you know.
Which of us, right?
Right. So $1.75, yeah, for a small. So here's how I'm thinking about this. And I'm the health home thing, John, is ambitious, but I'm not sure that we really have. We can, you know, we can sort of work on that, but I'm not sure that we can, you know, make it, that we can reshape it into our image, you know, quite quickly. But I do think we're about to, at some point over the next 6 months, do these interim BHOs. And then about that same time, 6 to 9 months or 12 months out, we're going to be start thinking about phase two BHOs. So I'm thinking that the interim BHOs are going to give us a kind of a ramping up on the one hand, and an experiment to begin to use data in some ways. So a lot of what you saw here, particularly in Susan's early presentation, you know, is what we expect to be measuring with the interim BHOs. But then it seems to me that there's no quick fix in the next 30 days for us to get all this stuff done. And so the place that it takes me is back to, I don't know who raised the point, but we had a conversation at a very first meeting about this group is not going to just meet over the summer and go away. So I think the place that I would propose to take this would be to say, and I checked with my coach here, who I think is willing to go along with this. If we say, so we, some of these things will make it their way into the report, and we have some work to do. And some of these things will be done on an interim basis in the interim BHOs. And this group is going to need to reconvene again. I'm not sure exactly when. Maybe as soon as we've survived the budget next year. You know, I don't want to be in the middle of that whole process. But about that time, it ought to be a good time to begin to look at how we're doing with the data from the interim BHOs, and what can we learn from that. So it's an opportunity for improvement, and it's an opportunity for feed forward to take some of these deeper ideas a little bit more into the design of the you know, the longer term BHOs and system. And there are multiple commitments there. It's a commitment. We still have to write the report. But another is to use the interim BHOs as a learning process, and then to reconvene this group to look at how we're doing about, you know, 6-9 months from now, probably 9 months from now, how are we doing on the one hand, and how can we build on this for the second phase of the process, which is 2013?
I mean, I do think that given what we've just talked about, if we can implement, those of us who are different kinds of providers, particularly the hospitals in this case, because that's where a lot of the money is, and can be saved and ought to be saved, and there ought to be some, but it's a lot of money, actually. I mean, it's a whole lot of money, I think. And so there ought to be some, we need some kind of a baseline so we know just how well we're saving money,
mm-hmm.
right? And then, and I think a lot of it, well, I think a lot of it will end up being saved downstairs, because that's what's stating to be obvious. I think there's got to be some way of sort of monitoring or keeping track of where all those savings are going, because it's going to be very tempting for the state to make its cap and declare victory with all that money. And when there's so many other kinds of needs that are unmet, I mean, I'm pretty much stating the obvious here. But it just seems to me that we ought to be very cognizant of that and try to declare it up front and maybe even try to estimate some of the savings, which actually I'm trying to do right now in Brooklyn as an example.
Sort of partner with that a little bit, I think, you know, for those of us sitting around the table that represent, you know, at or here usually in a role of advocate,
right.
I think we're somewhat challenged to say, like, when we walk away from this conversation, and we are dealing with a state budget, to what extent can we, or do we have any kind of shared vision about how the system ought to look,
mm-hmm.
based on the kind of conversation we have here, and to the extent that we can make a case and root it in, you know, maybe some of the baseline projections
mm-hmm.
of what savings could happen if the world worked
right.
the way we wanted it to. What happens if we're able to articulate a vision for where this should all go and how this should all work and do it in such a way that the administration is able to, again, they didn't have to invite us to be here, and so here we are. And so, you know, if you capitalize on the process on some level, understanding that at some point we walk away from the table and we do what we do, if we can still be somewhat in synchronicity in some way, we could really drive some good public policy changes potentially and influence the budget process and a whole lot of other things. So,
mm-hmm.
so I don't think it's such a bad thing for us to think about.
A suggestion going forward when this group does, you know, submit the report, but maybe while we're taking the hiatus and before we reconvene, we put together a watch list. We watch for good and we watch for bad. So each one of us would be doing some work while we're all apart, but look at some things that we're either worried about or really want to see, and then come back and be able to work with Susan and her group, too, and see if the data is showing that. But, you know, we put on put a watch list and say these are the things we want to really keep an eye on. We'll report back. Let's reconvene.
Yeah, yeah. Good idea.
Not a watch and worry list, a watch list.
Well, the doctors call it watchful waiting. So you wait, but you're watching some stuff while you're waiting to see if it's getting better or getting worse. Richard?
I was just going to stay with Pam's point for a second, because it was sort of a reality check. Ann and I were in a meeting last week talking about the Health and Hospitals Corporation, talking about experiences in other states where good things are happening with respect to strengthening the system. And so there was a lot of optimism about what happened in this one state with respect to kid services. And finally, the question was asked, so, well, you know, before you started this, was there any sort of infusion of resources that would have provided sort of, and of course the answer was, well, yeah, there was sort of there was an upfront investment that happened that allowed the DHO in this case to really sort of make the kind of dramatic changes in the delivery system, right? But it was sort of it was the right question to ask, because it was kind of a reality check that there either needs to be recognition that there is not the upfront, but to Pam's point, if it's not there on the front end, it needs to be captured and sort of available on the back end.
Was this in a state with a federal court consent decree regarding this issue?
I think they had an issue with
that. Yeah.
I think there was some
driving force.
Yes, there was some driving force.
On the budget. budget there.
It was an eastern
state. A little litigation goes
it was
an way.
Eastern state, yes.
The
situation it was an eastern state.
But the good results were there, but it wasn't without a little bit of, priming the pump. And that's just a reality check.
Yeah.
Well, so I think the conversation is good. So, on the one hand, our intention is to move forward with a lot of what Susan has presented. But we've also got a framework here for us to move forward in some fashion as we transition from, this phase to the interim phase to the next phase, which I think is a good place maybe to go into the next part of the conversation. Thank you, Susan. What we have here, I'm not sure if it's possible for us to do this, although we're pretty good at free-flowing conversation. We've identified here three or four of the big, semi-related, semi-unrelated issues that I'd like to open the floor for some conversation about, to primarily not try to get to a place of detailed recommendations, but to sort of see if we have any kind of a sense of the meeting about the direction that we ought to be exploring with respect to these issues. So let me just frame one of those. The first issue here, state inpatient facilities. So my proposition would be that the future at-risk plans could have some skin in the game vis-a-vis care in state hospitals. That is, they ought to have, maybe people that are in state hospitals ought to be enrolled, and there ought to be some ability to take, money out with the people. And that figuring that out is really complicated, because unless you figure it out right, people can be pulled out too fast and dumped or whatever. So the value proposition for me is, without having identified or thought through any of the details, to how does the group feel about an expectation that populations and resources in state hospitals should be considered vis-a-vis a component of BHO/SNP responsibility, recognizing that there's a whole bunch of stuff to work through that we're not going to work through this afternoon. So that'd be my... So any conversation about it? Anybody want to go a little bit deeper with that, or
I know there's at least one state where in fact there is a financial imperative, a financial incentive on the BHO to maintain a state census at a particular level. If it goes over, the BHO is on the hook financially for the cost of the service.
So it's a principle of risk sharing, and one of the principles here ought to be that the state PC ought to be available for those people who need it to the BHO and to the clients who need it, but also to the extent that that's not the best alternative for people, there ought to be the possibility of some alternative service provision. So this is I'm thinking of this as a two-way street. Now it's awfully complicated to easier said than done. But as at a level of principle, we're kind of sort of, that might make sense. John?
Yeah, I would say the other thing I'd say is, on the level of principle would be that everything's part of the conversation, that if we're talking about a standard of care, we're talking about outcome measures, we're talking about efficiencies, et cetera, we apply the same standard across the board, whether it's a state facility or a private hospital, a for-profit or not-for-profit, that there's some cross-cutting measures, and we all sort of use those same measures, and then we can make some decisions about where money is being used well, et cetera.
And, damn the state constitution and all those details, but yes, absolutely. That's one thing as a principle, and it's another thing to operationalize. I mean, I always say I'm stepping out of role here. I'm like speaking my other OMH role. So we run the state's third largest hospital system. We do it entirely within state government. We care for only people that have come from other institutions, and our costs are less. Okay, I'm done with that now.
In the mix of all that,
all are true. Both are true. So.
In the mix of all that, there has to be an issue of choice that has to be ever present. That
Yes, so that's a cross right. They'll always choice and appropriateness always have to drive this right.
So in the middle of the enthusiasm, I was a bit worried about. So I remember when I first came to the field, there was the beginning of reinvestment, right? So we closed hospitals and we reinvested.
Not too much, but. Yeah, right.
I'm not even speaking to
the
magnitude. But we closed some, and we reinvested some in community services.
And then, a few years later, it all got taken
away. The money has slipped away.
Right. All taken away.
But to the extent that there's, BHO involvement in the state hospitals, there needs to be some consideration, some, I don't know what, give back value consideration for the investment that the state has made in these state hospitals that should somehow be taken into consideration.
Right, and you want the investment, you don't want the bonded indebtedness. I can tell you that, because you got a couple billion dollars there, and you said you just want somebody to pay for that, but then you want to get the cash from the other side of it.
That's, well, I
want to. But, so that these are the cross currents that have to be worked out.
They do.
So, this for me is just testing it at a level of a concept. So we're interested in the concept, and we have a lot of issues and concerns with how it gets worked out.
Yeah, and in looking at the concept, I think it'd be helpful to also be creative about different levels of whatever you want to call beds or inpatient utilization. I think there's less restrictive things out there. There's models in other states of how beds can be used. And I think if you're going to do this, then I think let's get creative about kind of building as best as possible the best system that offers additional care between just acute and long-term. There's a lot of other stuff in the middle.
So I think that's a good point to transition on. We just have a general theme here, and that's probably about as deep as we can go into it with some caveats that have been added. So the second issue is housing. And so Linda has already said there will be a group convened with respect to affordable housing. So I guess what's on the table here would be what, I think the way you framed it was what initial recommendations would we want to both include in our report and transmit to that group for consideration. And I guess I would just sort of start this off by saying our first thought is that has come through in the conversation is that very often stable housing is a foundation for recovery. So we've established that. And a second is that there is not enough of it in New York State, and we need more. Those are about the only two things that I'm pretty clear about. And that let me sort of stop there because I'll get in trouble. Is there anything else that you'd want to sort of put on the table?
I think part of the premise, this gets back, I think, to some of the points that are being made about the more holistic approach toward recovery, is that unless you address the issue of housing, among other things, you're not going to get the savings that you're expecting to get out of the hospital system. And so it's that part of the successful path toward the cost savings that is motivating this whole conversation is that you've got to make investments in things like including housing.
So as New York 3 has demonstrated.
I can't say, neither of this group or the KISS group are dealing with transition age youth, appropriate housing for them, employment services, which is next on your list. Just so we don't forget about that group.
And family housing.
And I'm also wanting to be cognizant of the special issues of rural areas, particularly when it comes to housing.
There's another issue that is a sensitive one, as I just want to throw it out here, and it has to do with the fact that we have an awful lot of housing, much more of it developed in the mental health system, the addiction system, but certainly a lot of housing that's been developed. A lot of that is done through LGUs in the mental health system. And so what are we thinking about the relationship of the housing that's out there to the BHO? You know, so this is a loaded, proposition. So I might as well, I've already stuck my neck out. So let me go a little bit further with the proposition.
I'll let him keep going.
Until I get in trouble, and then so I think my proposition for discussion is that A, that housing is a valuable resource, that B, it serves purposes in populations other than the treatment that is our primary concern here, that those resources should be carefully brokered in relationship to care that is offered, but maybe that's best done through a partnership between, let's say, an LGU and a plan, as opposed to dumping the housing in the plan per se. That's a complicated proposition. I'm saying preserve the housing,
mm-hmm.
use it for the purposes of treatment, but not exclusively for the purposes of treatment. So a different way to articulate this concept would be to say we ought to have like a BHO kind of plan or a SNP kind of plan over here, and we ought to have like a housing plan over here, and they're going to have to partner very carefully. And the best way to resolve the tensions is to not throw everything in one pot, but to have two pots that are going to have to work carefully with each other. So that's my proposition.
Well,
a different way to put this would be to say recommendation, all OMH housing ought to be put in the SNPs or the BHOs. That'd be the other way to do it. I don't think we want to go there because these are both complicated tasks and, you know, we might either side might get overloaded. So let's kick this one around a little bit. What do you think?
Can you take our side first?
Okay. Yeah, you had your hand up. So.
You go first, Bill.
Well, you know, I think I like that idea. I think that it not only preserves the housing aspect of it and keeps it viable, it allows for other alternatives that LGUs can bring into the fold. We can have the you know, whether it's employment or other support services that may be available through the Department of Social Services in ways that are outside of the Medicaid reimbursed system. And, you know, I think that we need to establish some outcomes, you know, not just process pieces that we have now for housing, but outcomes and Susan's left, but you know that can be tracked and monitored so that is indeed working in partnership between the LGU and.
Let me just stay there for a second, and come over. And so you're taking that to another level. So I was just talking about housing, but you're saying there's actually a whole bunch of other stuff other than housing. Social services being a good example that are local government responsibility, and there is going to have to be a local government SNP or a local government BHO relationship that is going to be a constructive and a creative tension to balance those issues on the one hand and these issues on the other hand. Right? Is that, yeah? So,
my concern is if you keep them. I mean, there's reasons to keep them separate, but when you do, you're not. How do you align the incentives together in a way that really works so that some of the highest risk, kind of most difficult clients that you need housing for are really seen as people that the housing group wants to take? Now, the plan is going to want that because they want those patients out of hospitals and into housing. But as long as the housing group is over here, how do you make sure that housing group really will work with you on developing the housing? That's the problem we face now.
That's what the sheriff is saying, too.
How do you design it so that works? That's all I'm saying, right?
You have a lot of problems with housing, and I understand you want to make some recommendations to a housing group, but you do really have two systems that have very conflicting and competing kind of missions.
And you speak from some experience.
Right. and then you also have a lot of housing that's controlled really by the federal government and not necessarily by the state. Right. And then you have, there are a couple of ways you can tackle it. One way can be that when you look at HUD regulations, there are some reforms or some revisions that can be made to policies that are within the authority of HUD that don't require legislative action. Across the country, you have situations now where, let's say, some jurisdictions have banned people with drug-related felonies from ever getting subsidized housing. New York has not done that. And then you probably have, from county to county, you may have different policies. But you could do it from a policy point of view. You have success with some of the programs, your supportive housing programs, that mental health has done really well, expanded to substance use. But you're right. It's sort of not a continuum. It's really not a continuum. Right now, the drug treatment field, one of their biggest problems is that they can't qualify someone for housing.
Yeah.
Or even now, I run three veterans programs. If I have a veteran in residential treatment, they kind of don't qualify for
homeless housing. You got to talk to Donna, because she just got a big grant. They just got a big grant from the VA for, you know, for that population. But
well,
it's a
$10 million grant.
Cool.
It really is a very complicated issue, and I do think it's going to take some time to sit down and kind of work through policy, criteria, funding, whether you want to do things in the pipeline for the future.
So I'm thinking that maybe there's a point here to be captured and referred to the housing group. And that, because the affordable housing or supportive housing is on the one hand a state program, but it's also a federal program. And sort of, I think what you're really saying is that these different programs are going to need to be aligned better with these purposes, and housing is going to have to be maximized for multiple reasons and populations, including this one. And I'm not being very elegant about this. We are recommending a proactive approach to using, developing, and leveraging housing,
mm-hmm.
both through the state programs, but also the federal programs. I mean, this consolidated plan thing. You know, when HUD went to the consolidated plan, our people went to the end of the line because we weren't represented at the housing authority.
Right.
You know, so that. Anyway.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if it would be worth this group's time, but for New York, New York Free, we have a pretty well-honed system for screening and referring individuals based on a number of different service criteria, service eligibility categories to the supportive housing that was built for their purposes. So a plan of, you know, 9,000 units of development, broken down by 8 or 9 subcategories, and then very, very great work between 4 city agencies to manage the utilization of that space. So it's not sort of the willy-nilly whoever knocks on the door. It's a very clear queuing and prioritization. And it's worked well, and we have some pretty interesting data on the success of those programs to date. I think that's exactly the kind of model I have in mind in terms of the future conversation as we look at the units, so that we can really create direct accountability for the where the people are now being poorly served, to have them transition to better service units. I also think that there is other placements of those individuals that are in the continuum where we don't have a good coordination, and maybe it's
right.
a good sort of thing to build on at this point, to think about the other residential settings that are in the ambit of mostly state agencies and sometimes city agencies. And I think we've got a huge pickle, and Anne can speak on behalf of her organization, about individuals that are hospitalized and have these needs but are not Medicaid eligible,
and they just get
a wrench into the whole operation.
And just to remind, I think, because at least a lot of the data that is there, I'm assuming, is including emergency Medicaid when they've looked at all these costs, et cetera, and those patients sit in, I'm just telling you, they sit in hospitals on emergency Medicaid waiting. So there's a lot of dollars lost that could be converted into useful dollars for things like housing.
And
for
we
those
know, yeah.
uninsured
so we gotta,
patients.
We've got to figure out, we've got to look at where the flexible city and state dollars are that
That's
may not true. Be as restricted as the federal dollars, and we've got to get the housing people to the table.
Can
yeah.
I ask you a question? Are we talking about, when you combine the VHO and the housing, are you talking about that people have to be in care to have housing?
We're not talking about
combining.
Okay, I'm just wanting to make sure, because it's clear statements in the state-supported housing that it can't be tied to one another.
Right. They've got to be somehow. They got to be closely coordinated. But we're not talking about smushing them, I think.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. I do think I agree with Linda that what's within our control, we can work on. But at some point, you got to be bold, and you really got, if you wanted to do health care reform, you got to get the federal agency to work, to coordinate this together. And, you know, I would hope that we have someone, Secretary of HUD, that will listen to us, you know, if we decided to go that route at some point.
I would hope so.
I just want to add to it that we somehow transition all the community support services in the substance abuse side, community residents, sober homes, therapeutic communities that are currently providing housing through the local DSS offices or HRA in the city, that there's a connection so we could have a coordinated care, but also a step up or down in housing.
Yes. I don't want to get too deeply into that because it's really pretty complicated, and I don't think we can unpack it here, but there's both like housing, like an apartment subsidy, but we also have a fair amount of residential treatment.
Right.
That includes a place to live because it's residential treatment, and that's a little bit more complicated because that's got to be co-managed in some fashion.
If you look at it sort of from a hospital perspective, there was a point where the hospital system was overbedded, right? You can argue that maybe the residential drug treatment system is overbedded. And what you could do, and I think what Kathy's proposing, is to sort of re-engineer the system so that you have community residences with a lower level of care, where people can then be in housing and going to outpatient programs for services.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Just put me on the housing committee. We'll figure it out.
So I think we've gone about as deep as we can, but we're sort of moving to end, but we're not quite ending yet. So what else really needs to be said?
Thank you. I just want to mention that where the housing piece comes in from the LGU side is much through SPOA, and SPOA has no financial relationship to anyone other than to identify the high risk and prioritize them. So, Ellen, what you were saying is that's where the importance of really looking at SPOA and the link to housing outside of the BHO is important. And the only other point I wanted to make is that when we're looking at the housing piece, it works very differently in the city and Long Island and upwards. So keep in mind, too, the non-New York City, non-Long Island, upstate, and even the rural piece, too.
There, what I would look at, I don't know what the governor is necessarily doing with the combined agency, but if you look at areas of like community revitalization, you know, there can be some opportunities to create sort of pipeline.
We need to keep our eye on the back door. We're inviting everyone into the front porch.
Okay, so moving ahead here, let me try this again with respect to employment. This is like sort of a split the baby kind of a statement about sort of the question here is where are we going, vis-a-vis employment and it's like stage two SNFs or BHOs. And my view about this is it's a little bit like housing, but it's not a lot alike. For one thing, we don't really have a lot of employment services, and Medicaid per se cannot fund employment services. So that's a bummer on the one hand. On the other hand, we do know that having a job reduces your level of healthcare expenditures, whether it's because you're going to work instead of, clinic, or you're keeping yourself healthier or sort of whatever it is. So those two observations take me to a high-level principle, which is that we should be encouraging the stage two plans to work on and measure employment levels, even though it's not exactly their job to provide employment services. And there's a tension involved in that. But that's about as far as I think we can go with that tension. So just reactions, comments to that?
Why wouldn't we add in VESA training and other forms of training that Medicaid eligible people would qualify for?
Just because we don't, you know, the plans are not going to control it.
Right.
So it was the way that I would think about it is, yeah, so a plan may be looking for a special relationship
right.
with VESA to
right.
provide it.
Right.
I'd be all for that, but we can't exactly, you know, require or mandate that.
But then you
get
to the employment.
Just, I think, for context, and I don't know how the discussions will unfold in the next year or two or three, but I think very similar to housing, there's probably some data that talks about successful movement from homelessness to permanent housing or from unemployment to employment. And what I would maintain is that where people are engaged with the behavioral health system, and I know this is true for substance use disorders, and I assume so for mental health, where they're engaged in treatment and we're addressing employment and housing, I think we're doing a better job at times with moving people from unemployment to employment than are programs funded by the state for that specific purpose.
Hmm.
And similarly, at times doing a better job moving people from homelessness to permanent housing than our programs that are designed for that purpose. And so it's sort of a secondary gain of people going into treatment for their mental illness or for their addiction wind up with permanent jobs and in permanent housing. And so I would suggest that as we do our data piece, we begin to pay attention to that. And on some level, in this environment where the governor's talking about outcomes, if we believe that we can produce the outcomes, I think it's a good idea to think about this in the context of sweetening the kitty a little bit and incentivizing the outcomes, and particularly if we have the data that supports our ability to do the job. And
right. So that, and we're actually, I don't want to get too deep into this because it's off in the weeds, but we are in some conversations with, you know, particularly the State Department of Labor, and we're in some conversations with SSA about whether it might be possible to create some outcomes like that. And if we had some outcomes, if we could actively incentivize,
mm-hmm.
you know, plans and providers with new cash, that would be really helpful because we keep talking about reinvesting the money we don't have to do, you know, new and wonderful things. In this case, we actually have a strategy to maybe get some money. But
you could blend, that's a good idea. You could blend some of the existing funding into doing some of
those.
Maybe this is the way to put in the contracts and the RFPs that managed care plans would be inspected to identify employment goals and make referrals.
So good, you know, this is what good clinicians do. You know, how are things going at work? And, you know, are you thinking about getting back to work? So that's the way that I would think about it. It's not, So we have to measure it in some fashion, but it's not, at the same time, we don't expect in this environment to be giving plans large amounts of money to purchase employment services. So we got to be a little bit circumspect about this. So we want to create a productive tension there, but not get carried away.
Right.
All right. That's that feedback is very helpful to us in terms of having a sense of general direction here. So I want to sort of circle back, Linda, to where you started us off with a conversation about the next meeting. So we expect to have a report from the kids committee at that next meeting, and I think we expect to come back to you with a little staff work being done that will elaborate the outline of our report a little more, and then maybe bring for discussion those issues that we also intend to advance through the formal MRT process. Is that the way you're thinking about it?
So September 12th is dangerously close, but it feels like we ought to have a first draft of the document, right? So because I feel like we can go beyond an outline and get a document draft. Are you looking at the drafters?
They're getting up.
And I think we should have at least every topic that's going to be pursued in a fully fleshed out template identified. So templates should have headers and as much of the detail that we can. But I don't think that we'll be able to get. We could never get them all done by September 12th. But we should at least go through the process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and just my
mindful of today's targeted conversation was around outcomes and recognizing the connection of the way that you deliver outcomes in this world that we're moving into is through incentives and accountability. I think we might need to have a first draft outline on sort of payment systems, incentives, and outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's sort of the logical
that
progression from
helpful.
What we heard today.
I think.
Right?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good idea.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
To really bring it into focus.
So,
I think the sooner we can get the peer stuff, the better. That way we can, we can trade up, and we'll start to structure that sort of the handoff a little bit on the housing.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think we've also, we talked way back before, I think at the initial meeting about this can't end when it ends. It ain't over when it's over. But I think we got a little bit more explicit today in the conversation related to the data, just by way of saying the group is going to have to meet again during the interim BHO phase to take a look at progress and fine-tune recommendations for the next phase. That becomes, part of what's recommended also. This is quite, I guess the other thing I would say, so Kelly's holding up the draft. If you have a specific wants, needs, recommendations vis-a-vis the draft, send them to us. So I just say that. But this has been a remarkable conversation for its depth and breadth, and the fact that it's just two minutes after four,
and there was an earthquake.
We were undeterred.
How long was the room vibrating before somebody actually said, excuse me, is the room moving? Or is it just me?
I thought it was my head.
One other point. The question was raised about whether on 9/12, the day after 9/11, meeting downtown is going to be okay. And the deputy mayor believes that it is going to be okay, but it may think about that and consult with colleagues. And so
I'll ask. The only thing, it's a block away, and it's the first time that that it's open to the public. So the plaza is going to be open. Busy, that's all I was thinking.
Problems,
but busy
is all I was thinking, not even so much.
It's
not your factor, but just
the
is it the one in the afternoon, but, trains, I don't know, I just didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
If
it,
this is the World Trade Center and 12.
We're next door.
We're right next door.
Yeah.
So.
It'd be nice to look out and see right now.
I don't think we have enough, but they might have room.
Next week.
Then we'll have John Feinblatt directing traffic, so it will be.
Okay.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.